Kansas Public Radio has been broadcasting from the campus of the University of Kansas since 1952. And we've grown over the years. Kansas Public Radio now includes KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, KANQ Chanute, K210CR in Atchison, and K258BT in Manhattan. And if you can't remember all that, visit our website and find our call letters and frequencies listed for you. KansasPublicRadio.org.
Good morning. Would Donald Trump really use the military for retribution against perceived political rivals or to round up and deport migrants? I'll ask Trump's former Defense Secretary Mark Esper in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. Peek behind the scenes of a high-stakes election that'll decide the leader of one of the most powerful, influential organizations in the world. I mean, Martinez, that is what the new film Conclave is about. I'll speak to the star of the movie, Ray Fiennes. Also, President Joe Biden is in Arizona today to apologize to Native Americans for the government's role in forcing indigenous children into boarding schools. It's Friday, October 25th. Game one of the World Series is tonight, and it's also Yankee superstar slugger Juan Soto's 26th birthday. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Vice President Harris holds a rally in Houston, Texas today. She's expected to focus on abortion rights. She'll also be joined by music icon Beyoncé. Harris returned to the swing state of Georgia yesterday alongside former President Barack Obama. From member station WABE, Raul Bali reports the rally in suburban Atlanta included singer Bruce Springsteen and other entertainers.
Actor and filmmaker Tyler Perry reminded the crowd about Joe Biden's slim victory in Georgia in 2020.
So I stand here, full-throated, with my full chest, begging you, imploring you, let's get out and make Kamala Harris the 47th president.
Former President Obama said he understands people want to see change.
What I cannot understand is why anybody would think that Donald Trump will shake things up in a way that is good for you.
Harris reaffirmed her support for abortion rights and made a pitch to young voters saying they're, quote, rightly impatient for change. For NPR News, I'm Raul Bally in Clarkston, Georgia.
Former President Donald Trump campaigns today in Texas, too. He'll be joined by Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz. Trump was in Arizona and Nevada yesterday. He asked supporters in Las Vegas this question.
And I'd like to begin by asking a very simple question. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? I don't think so. What do you think? No way.
When Trump visits Austin, Texas today, he'll also be a guest on the popular Joe Rogan podcast. An Ohio judge has struck down a state abortion ban, even though it had not been enforced for a couple of years. The ruling comes almost a year after Ohio voters approved a state constitutional amendment protecting abortion access, contraception, and other reproductive decisions. The Ohio ban had outlawed most abortions as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy. A crew of four is safely back on Earth after spending well over 200 days at the International Space Station. From Central Florida Public Media, Brendan Byrne has more.
A SpaceX capsule carrying three NASA astronauts and a Russian cosmonaut splashed down off the coast of Pensacola, Florida, ending a nearly eight-month mission to the space station and back. The crew launched to the station back in March, and their planned return in August was delayed several times. First, the departure was pushed back as NASA worked through issues uncovered during the test flight of Boeing's Starliner capsule. More recently, Hurricane Milton caused unfavorable conditions at the capsule's splashdown locations off of Florida. It took the crew 34 hours to make the return home, safely splashing down under a canopy of parachutes. In all, the crew spent 235 days in space, the longest of any SpaceX human mission. For NPR News, I'm Brendan Byrne in Orlando.
On Wall Street, in pre-market trading, Dow futures are higher. This is NPR.
And good morning. For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Jay Schaefer. It's 6:04. Kansas Republicans in some competitive state legislative districts are updating their messaging on reproductive rights. The websites of several candidates now have nearly identical language about opposing a total abortion ban and supporting IVF treatment. Republican State Senator Mike Thompson of Shawnee has that messaging on his website, even though, according to his critics, he voted in favor of several bills that limit reproductive rights. He says attacks on his abortion stance just have no merit.
There's this constant push from both you guys in the media and from the Democrat Party to make this an issue in this election when there's nothing else they have to advance.
Thompson says voters care more about other issues like inflation, illegal immigration, and lowering income and property taxes. Republican messaging on abortion continues to shift as state lawmakers defend some competitive seats. With more on that, Zane Irwin of the Kansas News Service reports.
Several GOP candidates have new sections on their websites with titles like Just the Facts and Setting the Record Straight. The near identical language on each of them says the candidates oppose a total abortion ban and support access to IVF treatment. Last session, State Senator Mike Thompson voted against debating a bill to protect IVF. But his site says he supports the right, and he views the issue as an empty talking point for Democrats.
The IVF thing is one of those straw man arguments they're trying to distract the public from actual policy discussions.
Thompson says his constituents in Shawnee care more about lowering income and property taxes. For the Kansas News Service, I'm Zane Irwin.
Two people have been injured in southeast Kansas after a car collided with a horse and buggy. The Highway Patrol says the collision took place yesterday morning near Parsons. Troopers say the horse and buggy was halfway in the outside lane and on the shoulder when it was struck in the rear by a vehicle. KSNT reports the buggy driver, a 35-year-old woman from Cherryvale, was seriously hurt. So was her passenger, a 16-year-old girl. They were taken to Labette County Health in Parsons, their conditions unknown. The driver of the car is a 27-year-old woman from Neodesha. She was uninjured. K-State Wildcats are still in the running for a Big 12 championship, but they're hoping to avoid a stumble at 7 o'clock Saturday night in Manhattan against the Kansas Jayhawks. Only BYU and Iowa State remain unbeaten in the Big 12, both with 4-0 conference records and 7-0 overall. But the Wildcats are tied with three other teams with 3-1 conference records. The Wildcats have beaten KU 15 straight times, but Wildcats coach Chris Klieman says he has no plans to bring up the topic of K-State's string of victories over KU. In men's college basketball, a high-profile charity exhibition game gets underway tonight as KU takes on the Arkansas Razorbacks in Fayetteville.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. Former President Donald Trump has threatened to use the military against his political opponents if he's reelected. We'll hear from his former Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, who disagreed with Trump when he tried to deploy the National Guard against Black Lives Matter protesters. First, though, with less than 2 weeks left until Election Day, both presidential candidates are racing around the seven swing states. Today, they're both in Texas, one of the reddest states in the country. Trump has a big interview lined up, and Vice President Harris is trying to put abortion rights back in the spotlight. NPR's Deepa Shivaram is in Houston with the vice president. So, Deepa, why the Lone Star State?
Well, honestly, polls show that there's a huge gender divide in this campaign. Women favor Harris and men favoring Trump. And today's Texas stop kind of highlights that. Trump is taping the Joe Rogan podcast in Austin, which is a podcast that's very popular with young men. And it's a demographic he's trying to get out the vote with. Meanwhile, Harris is in Houston. She's taping a podcast with Brene Brown. It's popular among women. And this is Beyonce's hometown, and Beyonce is going to perform at the rally tonight for Harris. So a lot of things going on, but I will say it's more than Beyonce in this final stretch of the campaign. Harris is trying to bring her message on reproductive rights back into the forefront, and Texas has had some of the most restrictive abortion bans in the country. There are several women from Texas who, during this campaign, have shared their stories in speeches and ads of being denied an abortion when they needed them, which has put their lives at risk.
And how effective have those ads been?
You know, there is a new ad out this week, and I will say it's pretty memorable. It features a woman in Texas who was denied care when she had a miscarriage, and it shows a scar that she had from the emergency surgery that goes all the way down her entire chest, down to her stomach. And because of what happened, she may never be able to have children. It's the kind of image that it sticks in your head, you know, to show the impact of the Supreme Court decision. And the audio in the background of the ad is Trump saying he's going to be a, quote, protector of women. So this is definitely a topic that Democrats want to reignite attention on and make sure it's top of mind for voters.
Right. And reproductive rights have really been a big focus in the Senate race that's going on in Texas right now. That's Democratic Congressman Colin Allred challenging incumbent Senator Ted Cruz. Do Democrats maybe see this as a Senate seat that they can flip?
You know, as tight as this presidential race is, the race over who will control Congress is also really tight. And Texas has long been a red state. It's been 30 years since there was last a Democratic senator. I spoke with Brandon Rodinghouse. He's a professor of politics at the University of Houston. And he says the changing demographics in Texas in the last several years could maybe change things this time around.
The population has been surging with people moving here, and it's made the state much younger and much more racially and ethnically diverse. So it's really changing the dynamic of what Texas is politically.
And, you know, Allred has made reproductive rights a major focus in his campaign, and it's become a liability for Cruz in this race as Allred has hammered him on this issue. So this visit from Harris is pretty significant. She's a candidate who's short on time here, and for her to fly out to Houston and campaign with Allred shows that Democrats think they have a decent shot to flip this race.
All right, so where are Trump and Harris heading to next?
So last night I was with her as she rallied with Barack Obama in Atlanta. It was her biggest rally yet. There were about 20,000 people there. Tomorrow she heads to Kalamazoo, Michigan for a rally with Michelle Obama. Trump is headed to Michigan next as well. He has stops in Traverse City and then the Detroit suburbs. And both candidates will be in Pennsylvania this weekend too, going after those undecided voters and trying to drum up support from their bases.
Feels like the final turn of a very long race, right? NPR's Deepa Shivaram, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
A number of former aides to President Trump worry about how he might use the military if he's reelected. That's because he's repeatedly said things like what he told Fox's Maria Bartiromo earlier this month.
I think the bigger problem are the people from within. We have some very bad people. We have some sick people, radical left lunatics. And I think they're the and it should be very easily handled by, if necessary, by National Guard or if really necessary, by the military.
During the summer of 2020, Trump wanted to use active duty troops to quell Black Lives Matter demonstrations. His then Defense Secretary Mark Esper disagreed with him. Here's Esper speaking at the Pentagon that June.
The option to use active duty forces in a law enforcement role should only be used as a matter of last resort and only in the most urgent and dire of situations. We are not in one of those situations now.
Esper says he stayed on the job as long as he could until Trump fired him that November. I spoke to the former defense secretary yesterday, and I asked him about how he remembers his interactions with Trump during those turbulent months of 2020. We understand that after you said that, Mark Meadows called and screamed at you. I mean, really laid into you, expletive flying. And then at the White House, Donald Trump did the same thing. I mean, what was going on in your head when that was happening, when you were getting that kind of response to what you said?
I'd have to go back into my memoir and see exactly how I wrote it. And what I said at the Pentagon, which I think is what you're referring to, is I stood before the American public at the podium and said that there is no need for American troops unless it's something like in the most urgent and dire of circumstances, right? Because we have deployed federal troops in the past in certain situations at the request of the governors, though, and you think about the times of segregation. But in this circumstance, when the discussion within the Oval Office 2 days earlier was about using active duty troops to put down protests, peaceful protests, I thought that clearly crossed the line. And to me, that was the issue at hand. And that's why I felt, because as I wrote in my memoir, over the preceding 2 days, tensions continue to escalate in the country. More protests were breaking out in cities. And of course, now there was this shadow of the United States military being deployed. And I felt at the need, a day and a half later, on the morning of June 3rd, I believe, to go out publicly and say, I do not support invocation of the Insurrection Act.
Now, I was listening to an interview that you did a few years ago with my colleague, Michelle Martin, and you said that when Donald Trump asked, why can't you just shoot them in the leg, that it was a suggestion in the form of a question. That's how you described it. Why do you think he didn't just make it an actual presidential order?
That tended to be his style, was to kind of talk in terms of suggestions, or wouldn't it be great if somebody did this, or he was reluctant to give orders for some reason. But I think he was trying to take the temperature of the audience to see if there would be receptivity. And, you know, when he said that, we were all stunned, particularly General Mark Milley and myself, who were he was the ones we were principally talking to at that point in time.
Secretary, what do you think would have happened if Donald Trump had indeed made that an order?
Well, in this case, to deploy paratroopers into the streets of Washington, D.C., the worst of the worst would be that you would see active duty troops in the streets. Again, in the worst case scenario, they would be armed. And in the worst case scenario, like we saw at Kent State, they would fire their weapons. And I can say that with some credibility because I was a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne stationed in Europe. I understand the military ethic. I understand the nature of the Army, and I understand our history as well. And to me, there were a number of really bad outcomes, not least of which what would happen on the scene to peaceful protesters or even protesters who weren't peaceful but who were violent. You have that immediate negative of people getting shot, possibly killed, and what that means. You obviously would have a crisis within the government, given the fact that active duty troops were deployed in the streets of Washington, D.C.
You mentioned maybe a situation where it's urgent and dire. What would that mean? Give us a picture of what that would look like, where an urgent and dire situation would call for this.
Well, you could look back to our history, or you could just imagine situations. I mean, the Insurrection Act was about putting down insurrections or rebellion. So if you really literally had an armed rebellion that neither law enforcement, and this is how I thought through the process, law enforcement, either local or state or federal law enforcement, or the National Guard couldn't put down or control, that's when there is a role for active duty troops in that scenario.
In 1968, black service members refused to arrest people at the Chicago Democratic National Convention. Five dozen service members from Fort Hood were court-martialed. My colleague Tom Bowman talked to a retired senior U.S. official who said that if an administration used active military to deport migrants, that it could break the military. Secretary, do you see a similar scenario that you would be concerned about if that was something that an administration wanted to do when it comes to migrants?
I don't believe that the active duty military can be used to round up illegal persons in the country and deport them, if you will. I think it violates the Posse Comitatus Act, which basically restricts the U.S. military, the active duty military, from performing policing actions within the United States. And so there are some exceptions here and there, but they're very specific. So I don't believe that authority exists. But I'm not a lawyer, and I think it's something that needs to be looked at.
How concerned are you that if Donald Trump were to have a second administration, that he would not surround himself with people like you that would push back, that he would have people that would encourage him to act out on these impulses, these inclinations, as you call them?
My concern has always been in a second term that Trump and those around him learned the lesson that you have to get the right people in, people who will be loyal to you and what you want to do and your policies, people who aren't necessarily loyal to the Constitution, but to the president. And it's a big distinction. It's certainly a significant one when it comes to the oath of office to the Constitution that we all swear, but particularly the military.
Secretary, do you agree with John Kelly, Trump's former chief of staff and a former Marine general, who has said that Trump meets the definition of a fascist and, quote, prefers the dictator approach to government?
You know, I've said what's the terrible thing that's happened over the last several years is the public discourse has gotten too angry, too mean. There's too much name-calling, ad hominem attacks, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not going to put labels on this right now. But what I said the other day was this. If you go open up the dictionary and look at how fascism or a fascist is described, there's certain elements. And as you pick through that, you can't help but see where John Kelly's coming from and agree with some of the descriptions. And so I think each person should make their own judgment. I'm concerned, and I've put my caution out there to others as a warning.
That's former Defense Secretary Mark Esper. Secretary, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Support for KPR comes from Topeka's Noto Arts and Entertainment District, featuring a celebration of souls, Day of the Dead in southern Mexico. Exploring the Dia de los Muertos holiday traditions and origins, now till December 14th. Information.
It's Morning Edition on KPR. Following Morning Edition on KPR One, we will kick off Live Day. Right around 9 o'clock, we'll have the Midwest Chamber Ensemble of Kansas City performing live, playing trio music for piano, cello, and French horn. Around 10 o'clock this morning, we'll head over to the Lawrence Public Library for the Blue Stem Wind Ensemble, plus a great classical saxophonist. All of these musicians are from Washburn. So Live Day kicks off today. It will last all day long with the interruption of All Things Considered, of course, from 3 to 7. But then at 7 o'clock tonight, a special free concert at the Lawrence Public Library with KPR's own staff violinist, Destiny Ann Mermagan. Destiny and friends will perform for free at the Lawrence Public Library. We hope you'll show up tonight or at least tune in at 7 o'clock for Live Day here on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from Stoneback Appliance in Lawrence, locally owned for over 50 years, featuring new and used appliances from Maytag, Whirlpool, and more. We've got your back at StonebackAppliance.com.
Clear skies and 53 degrees here in Lawrence and in Topeka. Manhattan and Junction City, clear and 52. Chanute, 58, and in Emporia, clear sky, 53 degrees. Sunny and breezy today, a high of 68.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Nature Conservancy, working across oceans and isles to cut carbon emissions, protect lands and waters, and support local communities for a future where people and nature thrive. nature.org/solutions. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. If fiction depicts reality, then the election of a pope can be cutthroat. At least that's how it's portrayed in the new movie Conclave. In the opening scene, the pope is dead. His room is sealed. Cardinals from all over the world meet to select the next one. Ralph Fiennes plays Thomas Lawrence, dean of the College of Cardinals.
When the conclave begins and all the cardinals have arrived in the Vatican, they are sequestered. They have to be uninfluenced by outside events or people. And that is one of the key things. They are cut off.
Fiennes' character is in charge of managing the vote and the strong and various opinions about the future of the church. In a powerful monologue, Cardinal Lawrence offers a homily.
Cari fratelli in Cristo.
Actually, he starts the sermon in quite a sort of bland way, as if he will say sort of unsurprising elements about how we remember our Holy Father, how we wish the conclave will choose another worthy figure, blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly he stops.
But you know all that. Let me speak from the heart for a moment.
And he talks about the value of doubt.
Our faith is a living thing precisely because it walks hand in hand with doubt. If there was only certainty and no doubt, there would be no mystery and therefore no need for faith.
It's quite a sophisticated philosophical proposal, I think, but I think I interpret it as being we have to be open. We cannot lock ourselves rigidly into rules and dogma or doctrine in which we are not allowed to question. And I think he says this partly because of his own inner state, but also we understand he is allied to the figure of Cardinal Bellini. This is the cardinal played by Stanley Tucci, and he's the leading liberal candidate in the conclave. And being his ally, he is therefore saying if the church is to modernize, it has to question some of its sort of fixed beliefs or fixed rules.
Let's hear that clip. That is when you're talking to Stanley Tucci's character, because among the front runners for the papacy, an American with liberal views, that's played by Stanley Tucci, and then a conservative Italian who wants to take the church back into a very pre-Vatican II direction. So that's the current rift in the Catholic Church personified in these two men. Let's hear this.
Have you seen the papers?
Mm-hmm.
Apparently it's already decided it's to be me.
And I happen to agree with them.
What if I don't want it? No sane man would want the papacy.
Some of our colleagues seem to want it.
What if I know in my heart that I am not worthy?
You are more worthy than any of us.
I'm not.
Well, then tell your supporters not to vote for you, to pass the chalice.
And let it go to him? I could never live with myself.
So no sane man would want the papacy. I guess part of this is to talk about ambition, right? And what does that mean when someone is seeking leadership? I mean, is ambition a red flag when it comes to a job as powerful and as important as the Pope?
I don't know. I mean, where ambition becomes egocentric and self-serving is one thing. Where it is simply an ambition because you have a vision for a better church, I think these things one could debate endlessly. I think it's okay to be ambitious for something. I do think Stanley's character is, we understand he's ambitious, but I don't think he's ambitious for a self-aggrandizing way. It's not just about stopping Tedesco, it's also about advancing or bringing the church into the issues of sexual orientation, gender, women. Key liberal issues is what I think Stanley's character is advocating.
How much experience did you have or have you had in your life with the Catholic Church? Just wondering, considering how you played this role, if you had any experience with Catholicism.
I was brought up Catholic. My mother was a committed Catholic until I was about 13 when I rebelled. I said to my mother, I don't want to go to Mass anymore. I don't understand it. I don't feel it. I don't believe. This was in Ireland. We lived for a little time in Ireland, which at that time in the early 70s, the reach of the church into everyday life was very strong. But despite that, I've always carried in my adult life a real curiosity about a faith and a real interest in people who are committed to a life in the church.
Did you wind up spending any time in Rome with Vatican insiders to maybe study how the dean of the College of the Cardinals carries out their duties?
Yes, I did. I met some priests who were incredibly helpful, and they're thinkers. They're big thinkers, the people I met anyway. They're thinking philosophically a lot about these big questions. They're not. I didn't meet anyone who I felt was locked in defensively in relation to here's an actor playing a cardinal. I met open and kind people, actually, who said, yes, these are challenges. I found it quite inspirational because I didn't ever come across someone who said, oh, you know, this shouldn't happen.
Now, eventually the Cardinals do elect a pope, and this is where the film has quite a twist as an ending. It's in the book, but and I won't spoil the film right here. But in American politics, it would be as if an October surprise came after the election in November, after a decision was already made. Ray, that ending and the way it played out, is it meant to challenge people and the way they come up with a choice, where if new information comes in later, they're still good with their choice?
That's a good question. I mean, I think Lawrence is the man faced with this choice. I think he has the power to rescind the choice if he feels that the person that's been chosen doesn't tick all the required boxes. Yeah. And he encounters quite a complex question. The Pope has been elected, but he learns X, Y, Z. And I think it's handled with real sensitivity. In fact, it's saying the humanity of the person isn't in doubt, or the spiritual depth of the figure elected is not in question. This ambiguity is something Lawrence can live with. I think he's moved by what he learns about the new pope. There's a revelation, and at its essence, it is ambiguity.
That is Ray Fiennes. He's the star of the new film, Conclave. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, A. Good talking to you.
This is NPR News.
Inflation has taken center stage this presidential election season. Both candidates promised to improve the economy for Americans, but are voters buying it?
I just know how it was when he was in office. Financially, I was much better.
I'm Elsa Chang, checking in with Pennsylvania voters and their pocketbooks on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered beginning at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Laura Lorson will be your host from 3 to 7.
Support for KPR comes from Eagles Rest, a locally owned custom furniture store in downtown Lawrence featuring Stressless brand chairs and other sustainably made handcrafted furniture. Information online at EaglesRestNaturalHome.com.
It's 6:30. Time for this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Reproductive rights are expected to be a main focus today when Vice President Harris takes her presidential campaign to Texas. She spoke on that same issue yesterday when she addressed supporters at a rally in Georgia alongside former President Barack Obama.
I pledge to you, when Congress passes a bill to restore reproductive freedom nationwide, as President of the United States, I will proudly sign it into law.
Harris holds a rally this afternoon in Houston. Former President Donald Trump is expected to emphasize border security and illegal immigration when he travels today to Austin, Texas. The FBI is warning state and local officials that extremists with election grievances could turn to violence in the coming weeks. Sam Greenglass with member station WABE has more from Atlanta.
This FBI bulletin earlier this month highlighted that grievances like the perception of election fraud or anger toward perceived political adversaries poses the most likely threat of extremist violence, and warned that polling places or campaign events could be potential targets. They cited incidents earlier this year like hoax bomb threats to election offices and those two assassination attempts against former President Donald Trump.
This is NPR News.
And this is Kansas Public Radio News. Good morning, I'm Jay Schaefer. It's 6:31. Severe storms knocked out power to thousands across northeast Kansas last night. About 4,000 homes in the Topeka area lost electricity, and another 500 homes were hit in Jefferson County. Most of those power outages have been restored as of this morning. Spirit AeroSystems says it still expects to be acquired by Boeing, despite dismal earnings reports from both companies this week. Spirit reported that it had a net operating loss of $350 million in the third quarter, and for the year, the company has lost more than $1 billion. Boeing reported earlier this week a loss of $6 billion as it deals with an ongoing labor strike. The work stoppage has caused both companies to lay off or furlough workers, and Spirit says it expects to become part of Boeing anyway by the middle of next year. A Kansas cybersecurity expert says the state's plan to consolidate its information technology systems may be a good idea, but it must be flexible to protect information when cyber attacks occur. The state is overhauling its online security of sensitive information, partly in response to an attack on the Kansas court system last year. A new law calls for consolidating the state's cybersecurity systems into a centralized structure over the next several years. Alex Bardis is a computer scientist at KU. He says sensitive information and services need to be in modules within the centralized system, so they can be closed off from one another when attacks occur.
That module can actually be moved separately from the entire system, and you continue to, you know, be functional to do your services.
Bardis says a centralized structure without that kind of separation could leave the entire system vulnerable to cyber hacks. The 16th-ranked K-State Wildcats are still in the running for a Big 12 championship, but they're hoping to avoid a stumble at 7 o'clock tomorrow night in Manhattan against the KU Jayhawks. Greg Eklund has more.
Only BYU and Iowa State remain unbeaten in the Big 12, both with 4-0 conference records and 7-0 overall. But the Wildcats are tied with three other teams with 3-1 conference records. The Wildcats have beaten KU 15 straight times. But Wildcats coach Chris Kleiman says he had no plans to bring up the topic of K-State's string of wins over KU.
The last few years have been really competitive games, and we've found a way. Last year we were down 11 in the second half and found a way.
KU enters the game with an overall record of 2-5 and won its first conference game last weekend against Houston. This will be the 122nd meeting between KU and K-State. I'm Greg Eklund.
News, I'm E. Martinez. President Biden is expected to issue a formal apology today for the federal government's Native American boarding schools. With him in Arizona will be Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, America's first ever indigenous cabinet member. She made it a priority to right the government's historic wrongs, including abuses at boarding schools. Haaland recently spoke about it with NPR's Kirk Sigler at the Department of Interior.
The cavernous Stuart Udall Department of Interior building may be just off the National Mall in Washington, but it feels like a window into the Old West. Past the peculiar Indian craft shop, there are striking New Deal-era murals of firefighting and farming, and an Ansel Adams photograph of the Yakima Pueblo of New Mexico.
Our people were farming the desert for thousands of years, right, at Bears Ears and...
Yakima's just a few miles from where Deb Haaland spent much of her childhood at her grandmother's rock home in Mesita Village, Laguna Pueblo. Upstairs in the office of the department's first-ever Native secretary, Haaland says she thinks about her elders and the U.S. government's historical policy of assimilation every day.
My grandparents worked on the railroad for 45 years because of that, right? They were trying to get Indians out of their communities and into mainstream America.
Haaland's grandmother was sent to a Catholic boarding school as a little girl. School children were punished for speaking indigenous languages. Many were abused or worse, and there's still no full accounting of those who died.
It's an important piece of our history that every single American should know about. It's a painful part of our history.
Haaland, who also oversees the Bureau of Indian Affairs, recently wrapped up a nationwide healing tour across the country.
I think of that every single day. Those voices resonate with me every single day. It is very, very painful.
Haaland has also tried to right the wrongs of history by bringing tribes to the table on public lands decisions. Her department controls half a billion acres of land, including the national parks, cattle ranges, and oil and gas fields. She's increased tribal co-management agreements tenfold.
Tribal folks, they were our first land stewards. And so I feel that we've done an excellent job of lifting up Indian affairs and making sure that, across the board, it's important to our entire department.
Haaland knows it's ironic that she is now leading Interior. Historians say the agency was created after this country had fought off the British colonizers, only to then begin colonizing the American West.
The Department of the Interior, I don't know, you could almost call it the Department of Intense Irony and still keep the same initials.
Patty Limerick is a Western historian at the University of Colorado.
There's no question that the Department of the Interior comes into being to manage, direct, and control Indian peoples.
But Limerick says Deb Haaland's appointment will mark an important turn.
This is proof that we are not stuck with a historical legacy. This is proof that we have the power to say, let's change this.
Indeed, across Indian country, her appointment to lead federal agencies that long deprive Native people of their wealth and power, it means a lot. Chuck Hoskin Jr. is chief of the Cherokee Nation, one of America's biggest tribes.
Oh, I think her legacy is that she empowered Indian country and gave hope to particularly a generation of young Natives who look at a powerful Native woman in a position of great power demonstrating strength.
Haaland's appointment came with huge expectations. She herself points out that America's 574 federally recognized tribes are no monolith. And she's faced criticism for everything from tighter oil and gas drilling rules on the Navajo Reservation to not intervening in a lithium mining boom in Nevada on land tribes consider sacred. Here's how the longtime chairman of the Reno Sparks Indian Colony, Arlen Melendez, framed it before retiring late last year.
We want her to come out here at least to explain to the tribes as to what she can do, you know, besides remaining silent on it.
Holland says she's learned it's nearly impossible to be all things to everyone, and jokes that every day at least half the country is mad at her.
With respect to some of these projects, they didn't start with this administration. There were past administrations who were working on some of these.
She also found herself on the defense more recently over the Not Invisible Act, which she got passed as a member of Congress in 2019. It created a commission to advise the Interior and Justice Departments on their failure to solve missing persons and murder cases in Native communities. Some members criticized her for not acting fast enough. Holland is pleading for patience, saying Native women have been trafficked since colonization for 500 years.
Can things happen faster? Of course, things can always happen faster, but we are moving forward on this issue. When before, nobody cared about it.
As a tribal administrator, she remembers going to missing Indigenous people rallies where only a few family members showed up. Like boarding schools, Holland says these are now mainstream issues.
This was a turning point to acknowledge this painful era of our history, one that so many Americans had no clue about.
Holland won't say whether she'd stay on if a potential Kamala Harris administration were to ask. Donald Trump would likely roll back most of the Biden agenda, particularly a new controversial rule that allows public land to be leased for conservation instead of drilling. But Cherokee Chief Chuck Hoskins says Holland has raised the bar such that future presidents will appoint leaders who empower Indian country, not ignore it.
We have seen over the decades progress and then some level of retreat. I think overall we're on a path of progress in this country that is beyond party lines.
Secretary Holland points to the historic $45 billion the administration set aside for tribes, for everything from clean water to schools to bringing electricity to homes that still don't have it.
We're proud that tribes have had these this once-in-a-generation investment to make their communities better. Some, you know, there's tribes like the Hopi tribe in Arizona who are able to electrify homes with solar power for the first time ever.
Holland says she and the Biden administration have done things that will change Native people's lives forever, no matter who's in charge next. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Washington.
Later today in All Things Considered, the WNBA is getting larger crowds, more viewers, and bigger buzz than ever before. Player salaries, though, have not kept up. So the WNBA Players Association says it's time to bargain for a brand new contract. Listen live on the NPR app or your local station. This is NPR News.
As a KPR listener, you can leave an inspired and lasting gift to our community by making a gift through your will. For more information, talk with your legal or financial advisor or email us at membership@kansaspublicradio.org.
6:43 on this Friday morning. You're listening to Morning Edition on Kansas Public Radio. Live Day begins at 9 o'clock this morning as we listen to the Midwest Chamber Ensemble of Kansas City playing trio music for piano, cello, and French horn. Around 10 o'clock this morning, we'll head on over to the Lawrence Public Library for music from the Blue Stem Wind Ensemble, plus a great classical saxophonist. All of these musicians are from Washburn. And this is just some of what's in store for today during KPR's annual Live Day. Keep listening to KPR One for the music following Morning Edition.
Support for KPR comes from Assistive Technology for Kansans, providing people with disabilities and health conditions access to technology to live, work, and play safely. More information at atk.ku.edu.
Sunny and breezy weather today. We'll have a high of 68 degrees. It's 6:44.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, it's our annual Halloween Spooktacular, featuring all manner of music from monsters, munsters, mummies, and other people in show business. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour, Saturday night at 7 on KPR.
Good morning, May Martinez. A lady in Ipswich, England, was out during the early hours one morning this week, and she saw a pinkish-reddish glow. At first, she thought it was something on fire. Then she remembered the northern lights were spotted in the UK skies a couple of weeks earlier and thought, was it an aurora? And she started snapping some pictures. Her social media followers let her know it was just the lights from a nearby tomato factory used to boost plant growth. Wah, wah. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. The Federal Trade Commission has approved a regulation called the click-to-cancel rule. It's aimed at companies that make it intentionally difficult for customers to cancel subscriptions, which you might have noticed are now a pretty big business model. Alexi Horowitz-Ghazi of our Planet Money team looked at why.
For a long time, the subscription business model was kind of niche. Think newspapers or milk delivery. But now, everything from razor blades to car washes are available as a subscription. To figure out why, I reached out to Teen Zuo, the founder and CEO of a subscription logistics company called Zwora.
We're a little bit invisible, right, to you. You might not know that we exist, but we're powering the money transactions behind anything from Zoom to the New York Times to General Motors, to power all sorts of subscription services.
Teen explains that our modern subscription-obsessed economy can be traced back to one Silicon Valley company in the late 90s, where he was an early employee.
Well, I think the company that people would point to is Salesforce.
Salesforce makes database software for other companies to keep track of sales and marketing. And up until that point, Teen says, the software industry was organized around selling individual goods, CDs with programs like Microsoft Word or Adobe Photoshop.
Despite the fact that software was a digital product, it was very much sold on a unit basis.
The thing that Teen and his colleagues at Salesforce realized was that in the age of the internet, they could try a different model.
Let's create software that people don't have to buy, that we run, that we operate, and you simply point your browser at our servers, and we'll just take care of it for you.
Salesforce started offering their software as a service. Now, instead of buying your own copy of some program for a hefty sticker price, you can essentially rent it and spread the cost into smaller recurring payments every month. That made it affordable to more customers, and it gave Salesforce a more predictable stream of income. Within a few years, the company proved this model could be a $1 billion business. Venture capitalists started investing more into startups that offered software as a service, and the model blew up with things like Netflix and Spotify.
At this point, does it feel like there's a kind of pressure on almost any type of company if they're trying to convince investors to back them to use a subscription model?
I think I'd be hard-pressed to see a venture capitalist fund a company that does not have a strong recurring subscription model.
But the ubiquity of the subscription model has also come with a dark side. Over the past few years, consumer protection agencies like the Federal Trade Commission have received tens of thousands of complaints from customers about companies with opaque terms of service and cancellation processes that are nearly impossible.
Subscription traps are a market failure.
Sam Levine is the head of consumer protection at the FTC. The agency has brought several high-profile lawsuits against companies that they see as the worst offenders. And earlier this month, they passed Click to Cancel, requiring companies to make it just as easy to cancel a service as it was to sign up or risk a fine.
Yeah, you can trap people and maybe it'll earn you another $6.99 a month. But if you're caught, you could be liable for civil penalties of more than $50,000 per violation. And that's just basic deterrence theory.
Sam says the rule is slated to go into effect in about 6 months. In the meantime, he says, there are apps to track and cancel your subscriptions for you, but only if you're willing to pay a monthly fee. Alexi Horowitz-Ghazi, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News.
Support for KPR comes from the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu.
6:50 on this Friday morning. It's Morning Edition on KPR. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll have a summary of news headlines from around the world and across the state. It's going to be a beautiful fall day with sunshine, breezy conditions, a high of 68. Tonight, a low of 34. And tomorrow, sunny, a high of 66 on Saturday. Sunday will bring sunshine and a high in the mid-70s.
Support for KPR comes from Maselli's, presenting Cabaret Brunch, featuring Mary Baker and friends on October 27th. Brunch buffet at 10 a.m. Show starts at 11. Information and tickets available at masellisonline.com.
Clear skies, 52 at KU. In Manhattan and Junction City, it's 51 degrees. Chanute, clear skies, 57. And in Emporia, clear and 53. As part of our annual Live Day broadcast, which gets underway at 9 o'clock this morning on KPR1, we'll also be presenting a special free Halloween concert tonight with KPR staffer and violinist Destiny Ann Mermegan and friends. The evening concert begins at 7 o'clock tonight, Lawrence Public Library's auditorium. It'll cap off an entire day's worth of live classical music today on KPR One stations. It's 6:51.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. With the presidential election just a week and a half away, both candidates keep talking about the last one and what happened right after it. But how Vice President Harris and former President Trump described January 6th could not be more different.
Some of those people went down to the Capitol. I said, peacefully and patriotically, nothing done wrong.
He sent an armed mob to the United States Capitol, where they assaulted law enforcement officers.
But that was a day of love.
He fanned the flames.
Nearly 4 years later, the nation is still coming to terms with what happened at the storming of the Capitol and who participated. An NPR investigation shows nearly one in five people arrested in connection with the attack have military service records. One of them was Sergeant Josh Abate, who followed the crowd along with two fellow Marines, Sergeant Dodge Helenin and Corporal Micah Coomer. NPR's Tom Bowman and Lauren Hodges followed the story for a new podcast with our colleagues at Embedded. Here's a snippet.
Josh sat down with both of us for hours, talked about how he ended up in the Capitol. The election had just wrapped up, and he was buying into the claims on conservative media outlets that Joe Biden's victory had been fraudulent.
Now, Josh claims he just went to D.C. on January 6th to hear Trump speak and ended up in the wrong place at the wrong time, the Capitol attack. He describes a very different scene than what Lauren and I saw out there that day. He says, there was no violence, no aggression. They just walked in, strolled around the Capitol, took pictures. That just didn't sound right to us. No chanting, no big crowds, we asked. Nope, I have nothing to hide, Josh told us.
And you said you wanted to add a few things?
Yeah, I got a couple bullet points.
Okay.
When we sat down, he handed me this one sheet of paper. It was part of the FBI's official statement of facts. And he's like, look, this is all they've got on me.
Vate appears in the crowd, and then he walks. And it just, it talks about how we walk and walk. Right. And nothing in their summary of our actions is actually, you know, violent or scary.
He kept using the word humorous.
I thought it was humorous, but they, in their summary of me, like my time in the Capitol building, that's all they could really sum it up to was walking.
And then I looked at the bottom of the page, and it says, like, 1 of 45.
But there's more to this story than just some missing pages. There's also video evidence.
The FBI investigation into Josh relied on these screenshots in the Capitol that mostly came from surveillance footage inside. We didn't have access to that. But a few weeks after we talked to Josh, we got an unexpected assist. House Republicans started dropping some 5,000 hours of security camera footage from January 6th on a public video platform.
7 minutes after the doors and windows to the hallway are breached, Josh walks in with Helen and Coomer.
They slowly make their way to the front of this crowd about 20 feet away from the door to the House chamber. And at one point, Josh cups his hands around his mouth. And when you watch the video, it's pretty clear he's chanting, "Stop the steal. Stop the steal."
At another point, Josh is holding a "Don't Tread on Me" flag just before tear gas starts to fill the space.
At that point, Josh and his friends leave that hallway and end up in the Capitol Rotunda in a huge crowd. They help a guy try to put a MAGA hat on a statue, and Josh is the one who finally gets it up there by actually climbing the statue.
When Josh admitted to putting a hat on a statue, he told us he didn't remember which statue it was. But Lauren and I have seen this bust up close. In shiny gold lettering, it reads,
"Martin Luther King Jr."
It's hard to miss.
It's only when the police, in riot gear no less, form a line and start to push everyone out that Josh, along with Helen and Coomer, are finally forced to leave the rotunda. It's clear that the video doesn't match up with Josh's story. Josh said he didn't see any violence. It was peaceful. He didn't do anything but walk around. That's just not true.
That's NPR's Lauren Hodges and Tom Bowman. Their new podcast with Embedded called A Good Guy is out now on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts. A juvenile humpback whale nicknamed Sweet Girl died near the main island of Tahiti. That spurred an effort to change how fast boats can travel during whale watching season. Here's NPR's Líquidos.
In this video captured by the environmental group Mata Tahora, we hear Sweet Girl crying in pain. She struggles to keep swimming as blood pours from a deep cut in her upper mouth. Locals believe she was hit and killed by a large speeding vessel. Underwater photographer Rachel Moore lives on Tahiti and was swimming with Sweet Girl just days before the accident.
Sweet Girl was coming around to see everyone in the water.
In a video on Moore's Instagram, the curious whale twirls in the water and doesn't shy away from the humans.
It was the most powerful 10 minutes of my life.
When Moore found out about Sweet Girl's death, she was devastated. Authorities are still trying to figure out who's responsible, but there is speculation that the boat that hit Sweet Girl was traveling about 34 miles per hour, almost 6 times the current speed limit for vessels traveling near Tahiti. That is why Moore has started a petition to change the speed limit during whale watching season.
If ships can stay below 12 knots, at least inside of the lagoon in the first 2 kilometers, that alone will protect a larger percentage of whales here.
Thousands of whales are killed by vessels every year. But this incident, which has garnered international support, pits the need for islanders and tourists to get around directly against the whales that frequent the South Pacific Island territory to mate and give birth.
Personally, I got really affected because I've been swimming with the whales recently with my friends.
Caroline Rainbow is a travel consultant on the island of Mo'odia, about 33 miles from Tahiti. She signed the petition. Still, she says even though whale watching season is very popular, locals are split about changing the speed limit for boats.
a lot of the people that actually commute to go to Tahiti, going back morning and night on the ferries, they only want one thing, to reach the island in about 25 minutes because they're so tired at the end of the day that they just want to reach the island.
The petition currently has some 15,000 signatures. Rachel Moore has a higher goal, 280,000, the population of French Polynesia, before she officially presents the petition to the government. Lily Quiros, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
We're live, we're local, we are. From the University of Kansas, this is KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, and KANQ Chanute. You'll find us broadcasting online at kansaspublicradio.org. Clear skies all across eastern Kansas this morning. It's 52 at KU. Today we'll have sunshine, breezy conditions with winds from the north and a high of 68 degrees. It's 7 o'clock.
Good morning. What's the political debate like in a swing ward, in a swing town, in a swing county, in a swing state? Michelle Martin reports from Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley on this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. As the election nears, election officials in swing states are on edge. Voters are too. I'm E. Martinez. As the FBI warns of potential violence in coming weeks, we'll hear what Trump and Harris supporters in Georgia make of the campaign's political rhetoric. Plus, prosecutors in Los Angeles say two brothers convicted of killing their parents should be resentenced and released from prison. It's Friday, October 25th. Happy 70th birthday to Olympic gold medalist Mike Arruzioni, who led the U.S. hockey team that upset the Soviet Union in the 1980 Winter Olympics. Do you believe in miracles? Yes. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Both presidential candidates will campaign in Texas today. Former President Donald Trump will campaign with Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz. Vice President Harris will campaign with Cruz's opponent, Democratic Congressman Colin Allred. NPR's Deepa Shivaram tells us both Trump and Harris will also be guests on popular podcasts.
Polls show that there's a huge gender divide in this campaign. Women overwhelmingly favor Harris and men favoring Trump. And today's Texas stop kind of highlights that. Trump is taping the Joe Rogan podcast in Austin, which is a podcast that's very popular with young men. And it's a demographic he's trying to get out the vote with. Meanwhile, Harris is in Houston. She's taping a podcast with Brene Brown. It's popular among women.
NPR's Deepa Shivaram reporting. The U.S. Postal Service is urging mail-in voters to return their ballots early because Election Day is fewer than 2 weeks away. As NPR's Hansi Lo Wong reports, some parts of the country have been experiencing delays and other problems with election mail.
U.S. Postal Service officials say close to 98% of mail-in ballots were delivered on time in the first 3 weeks of October. But there have been some isolated local glitches, including in Pennsylvania. Asia Marshall says this week the Postal Service started doing the extra deliveries and special pickups it usually does in the final weeks before a general election's last day of voting.
We encourage anyone choosing to vote by mail to please mail early.
Marshall says mail-in voters should return their ballots at least 1 week before their state's deadlines. And to make sure those ballots get a postmark,
simply bring in your ballot to make sure it's postmarked from your local post office.
Some states require postmarks as proof that a ballot was returned on time. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in London for meetings with the leaders of three Middle Eastern countries. As Robbie Griffiths reports, the meetings are the last stop on his latest tour, which hopes to slow the escalating violence in the region.
Blinken met with the Lebanese caretaker prime minister to discuss the Israeli military campaign against Hezbollah, which has killed almost 2,000 people in the past 5 weeks. Blinken is also meeting the foreign ministers from Jordan and the United Arab Emirates, where he's expected to discuss recovery in the Gaza Strip. At a press conference on Thursday, Blinken said Israel's fight against Hezbollah should not lead to a protracted campaign in Lebanon, and urged Israel to protect civilians. Lebanese state media said an Israeli airstrike killed three journalists in southern Lebanon overnight. For NPR News, I'm Robbie Griffiths in London.
UN peacekeepers in southern Lebanon say troops with the Israeli military fired on a group of them this week. The peacekeepers say they were in a permanent UN station when Israeli troops saw them and started shooting. The peacekeepers withdrew, but the UN says they are remaining in Lebanon. The UN adds Israel is obligated to ensure peacekeepers' safety, and any deliberate attack violates international humanitarian law. This is NPR.
And this is KPR News. Good morning, I'm Jay Schaefer. Severe storms knocked out power to thousands across northeast Kansas last night. About 4,000 homes in the Topeka area lost electricity, and another 500 homes were hit in Jefferson County. As of this morning, about 833 customers are still waiting for power to be restored. Spirit AeroSystems says it still expects to be acquired by Boeing, despite some dismal earnings reports this week from both companies.
Spirit is reporting a net operating loss of $350 million for the third quarter. That brings losses for the year to more than $1 billion. Boeing, meanwhile, reported losses of $6 billion for the quarter as it deals with an ongoing labor strike. The work stoppage has caused both companies to lay off or furlough workers. About 700 employee furloughs begin Monday at Spirit. Despite the difficult financial news, Spirit says it expects to become a wholly owned subsidiary of Boeing by the middle of next year. Spirit is Wichita's largest employer. I'm Tom Schein.
Kansas Republicans in some competitive state legislative districts are updating their messaging on reproductive rights. The websites of several candidates now have nearly identical language about opposing a total abortion ban and supporting IVF treatment. Republican State Senator Mike Thompson of Shawnee has that kind of messaging on his website, even though, according to his critics, he voted in favor of bills that limit reproductive rights. He says attacks on his abortion stance have no merit.
There's this constant push from both you guys in the media and from the Democrat Party to make this an issue in this election when there's nothing else they have to advance.
Thompson says voters care more about other issues like inflation, illegal immigration, and lowering property taxes. Two people have been injured in southeast Kansas after a car collided with a horse and buggy. The Highway Patrol says the collision took place yesterday morning near Parsons. Troopers say the horse and buggy was halfway in the outside lane and shoulder when it was struck in the rear by a vehicle. KSNT reports that the buggy driver, a 35-year-old woman from Cherryvale, was seriously hurt. So was her passenger, a 16-year-old girl. The 16th-ranked Kansas State Wildcats are still in the running for a Big 12 championship, but they're hoping to avoid a stumble at 7 o'clock tomorrow night in Manhattan against the Kansas Jayhawks.
Only BYU and Iowa State remain unbeaten in the Big 12, both with 4-0 conference records and 7-0 overall. But the Wildcats are tied with three other teams with 3-1 conference records. The Wildcats have beaten KU 15 straight times. But Wildcats coach Chris Kleiman says he had no plans to bring up the topic.
The last few years have been really competitive games, and we've found a way. Last year we were down 11 in the second half and found a way.
KU enters the game with an overall record of 2-5 and won its first conference game last weekend against Houston. I'm Greg Eklund.
Sunny skies, breezy conditions today. We'll have a high of 68. This is KPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Philadelphia. In the swing state of Pennsylvania, Northampton County is both a bellwether and a boomerang. It tends to pick the winner in presidential elections, Barack Obama, then Donald Trump, then Joe Biden. Chris Borick says the shifts reflect the diversity of the Lehigh Valley, straddling the turnpike between Philadelphia and Scranton.
You got a lot of individuals, multi-generational, working class individuals living close side by side.
Bork lives in the community of Nazareth. He teaches political science and directs the Institute of Public Opinion at nearby Muhlenberg College.
My house is next to a dentist office next door, and across the street is the old Martin Guitar factory. It's that kind of mix between people, between different types of professions, different types of businesses that really produce the cocktail, if you will, that makes it such a competitive place.
A competition that's hard to escape.
I just walked in my front door and picked up my daily load of mailers from the candidates. On a weekend, the streets abuzz with people coming from all the campaigns, knocking door to door. So it is about as energetic as an electoral scene as you could ever find.
Voter opinions in neighboring Bethlehem are as varied as the campaigns vying for their attention. A local activist, Kim Plyler, helped us invite both Democrats and Republicans to chat. Here's some of what we heard from Elizabeth Bennett, Jeff Opp, Amy Cohen, Gary Reister, and Marty Plyler.
When Hillary lost the election in 2016, there was an outcry from the left-wing Democrats, like, this is fake, this is not right, she won the election. Including,
she did. She won the popular vote. Hold on,
she did win the popular vote. But go ahead, let him.
See, now that's why we have the Electoral College.
The Electoral College is bogus.
Okay,
no,
okay. Gary, help us.
And do not know. You're Gary. Wrong in that, and let me finish my point.
Yeah, let him finish his point.
The anger on the left side, the progressive Democrats.
I have a 29-year-old son and a 26-year-old daughter. My daughter is now at risk, and my son is not. It's not about abortion. It's about rescinding our rights as women to make decisions about our health care.
Track record. You had 4 years of Donald Trump. You look at the economics, we're stronger in the world. And then you look at 4 years of Biden-Harris, high inflation, no job creation, the economy is not as good as it was, and we're weaker in the world.
It's difficult for people in the middle class, if you can call them middle class anymore, to get a leg up. Republicans especially, sorry, Jeff, are exploiting the pain that people feel economically in order to demonize each side.
I believe in honesty and transparency. Neither one of them are really honest. But Trump is less honest than Kamala. So that's how I see it.
He is sometimes a real jerk. But I look at the results. And sometimes you could have a boss that's a jerk, but at the same time, if he produces results, he produces results. And I'm going with Trump on that.
Heated moments, but these voters made a point to hug it out afterward. And like other places in Pennsylvania we visited, we heard a longing for more civility, less heat, more space for a middle ground.
I remember watching William F. Buckley on TV where they have a debate with a Democrat and a Republican. And they actually, you listen, and sometimes you agreed with, even though you may be a Democrat, you agreed with a couple of things Republicans said, and other times you didn't. And that does not take place anymore.
We had this conversation inside one of the entertainment venues that now occupy an area where Bethlehem Steel was produced. These massive blast furnaces dating back to the time of the Civil War went silent in 1995. Almost 30 years later, they're surrounded by a park and performing arts venues that former mayor and county executive Don Cunningham helped bring to life. Cunningham and I talked in the shadow of those blast furnaces, now rusting, but surrounded by a landscaped walkway.
People used to say all politics is local. Remember that?
It's
people
all
used to say
all now. Unfortunately, like the work that we've done here to revitalize this area, yeah, quite honestly didn't involve presidents. It yeah. was us.
Yeah.
You know, it went on for 20 plus years. Democrats, Republicans came and went from the White House, and we kept our head down and did what we needed to do.
Do you think you could get elected today?
I don't think so.
How come?
I'm not ideological enough for today. I probably couldn't get through a primary.
He's talking about the kind of sharp divides that political scientist Chris Borick says may explain why the campaigns target Northampton County.
If there's one word I've said over and over and over throughout the fall, it's margin, because it is a state that is won and lost on the margin. Everybody's looking for the magical group. They're saying, what's the key group? What's the group that's going to change Pennsylvania? And I say all of them.
In the first ward of the borough of Nazareth, just 3 votes made the difference in 2020. In a swing ward, in a swing town, swing county, and swing state, this year's outcome is almost impossible to predict.
Los Angeles District Attorney George Gascon is recommending that the Menendez brothers be resentenced and released from prison. Eric and Lyle Menendez were convicted of killing their parents in Beverly Hills in 1989. Now, the trial was televised and drew international attention. It also inspired a number of films, TV series, and also documentaries. Frank Stoltz is a civics and democracy correspondent for LAist. He's been following the developments. Frank, first remind us about this case. What was it all about?
Sure. Eric Menendez was 18 years old and his brother Lyle was 21 when they killed their parents with shotguns as they were watching TV one night. At first, police believed their story that intruders committed the crime, that they merely came home and found their parents dead. But when the brothers went on a lavish spending spree with their parents' money, buying a Rolex watch and Porsche car, investigators became suspicious. They ended up arresting them for the killings. Their case burst back into the spotlight this year when it was the subject of a documentary and of a crime drama by Ryan Murphy on Netflix.
Now, the Menendez brothers filed a petition about their case in 2023, citing new evidence that contributed to this decision. What was that new evidence?
Yes, there was new evidence supporting the allegation of sexual abuse by their father that Gascon had been reviewing. Some of that came to light in a Peacock documentary from 2023. In it, Roy Rosello, a member of the Puerto Rican boy band Menudo, made his own allegation, which was taken to help corroborate the Menendez brothers' accusations. And around the same time, there was also the revelation of a letter from Eric Menendez to a cousin documenting the alleged abuse. All along, the brothers have said they did it because of their father's sexual abuse of them and a fear that their father was going to kill them. While not condoning the murder, Gascon said it's important to understand the brothers' desperation as victims of their father's sexual abuse.
They have been in prison for nearly 35 years. I believe that they have paid their debt to society.
Gascon is recommending the brothers be immediately eligible for parole because they committed the crimes when they were under 26 years old. California's youthful offender law would make them immediately eligible for parole if they get resentenced.
So, what a turn of events there. Was this a surprising move by George Gascon?
No, not at all. George Gascon is one of the nation's most progressive prosecutors. He sought the resentencing of more than 300 people during his 4 years in office. Gascon did note that not everyone in his office agreed with his decision. Some believe the brothers should remain in prison.
What about reaction from the Menendez family?
Well, about a half a dozen of them were at the press conference and thanked Gascon, including the Menendez cousin, Joan Vandermeulen.
This decision is not just a legal matter. It is a recognition of the abuse my cousins endured.
Not all members of the Menendez family want to see the brothers, now 53 and 56 years old, released. Their mother's brother, Milton Anderson, wants them to stay in prison. His attorney described the brothers' act as, quote, cold-blooded murder. A judge will decide whether to resentence the brothers, and a parole board will decide whether they'll be released, and all of that, could take months.
All right, that's Frank Stoltz of member station LAist in Los Angeles. Frank, thanks.
Thank you.
Federal health officials are sharing their investigation into a particularly troubling bird flu case in Missouri, a case that led to suspicions the virus had jumped from human to human. Here's NPR's Will Stone.
In almost every instance when a person has ended up with bird flu, there's been an explanation, some link to infected poultry or dairy cattle. Not so for the patient in Missouri. That person who was hospitalized in August did not have any known exposure. Plus, it seemed like they may have spread the virus to half a dozen healthcare workers who said they later developed symptoms. It was an alarming possibility. Luckily, it seems that did not happen. Three kinds of tests found no evidence of bird flu infections in the healthcare workers. Here's Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
This finding rules out person-to-person spread between the index case and any of the healthcare workers with which they interacted at the hospital.
But a household contact of that hospitalized patient or index case does seem to have been sick at the same time. Testing wasn't 100% conclusive. That said, it did show the person had antibodies against bird flu. Daskalakis says their suspicion is that both people caught the virus in the same way.
I can't predict or can't retrospectively guess what that exposure was, but the force of evidence really supports some sort of animal or animal product exposure that happened at the same time.
What's puzzling is that Missouri has not reported a single dairy herd infection during the outbreak. Dr. Amish Adalja is a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security.
The working assumption has to be that there are dairy cattle in Missouri that have this infection and they need to find it.
Adalja says there are still so many unanswered questions. He believes the state needs to be more proactive and transparent.
They haven't still released, you know, what hospital he was treated at, what county he lives in, how many dairy farms are within a 20-mile radius. These are very obvious things to do.
Which is not to say Missouri is the only concern. Nationwide, the situation is far from contained. Washington State is finding its first human cases. In California, infections have hit dozens of herds this month, and 15 people there have caught the virus. Adalja says the U.S. has been lucky. This is a pretty forgiving bird flu virus. No one is dying. In the future, that may not be the case. Will Stone, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The place to find NPR News, it's Kansas Public Radio. 7:19 on this Friday morning. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello. Sunday, November 3rd, 2 p.m. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu.
Evergy says hundreds of customers across northeast Kansas remain without power this morning. Some strong storms rolled through our area last night, knocking out power to about 4,000 homes in the Topeka area and another 500 homes in Jefferson County. But as of right now, only about 579 customers are without power here in northeast Kansas. We'll keep an eye on Evergy's outage map. We'll bring you more news headlines in about 10 minutes here on Morning Edition.
Support for KPR comes from Spider Art Constructors, offering decorative, stamped, and stained concrete patio work across the KPR listening area. More information about creating your backyard oasis is at Spider Art, Spider with a Y, SpiderArtConstructors.com.
Clear skies and 52 at KU. In Topeka and Manhattan this morning, 51 degrees. And in Emporia, it is clear and 52 degrees. We expect sunshine today, breezy conditions with a high of 68 degrees. Tomorrow, sunny and a high of 66. Don't forget, Live Day begins at 9 o'clock this morning on KPR. We'll have classical music performed live all day long from the KPR studios as well as the Lawrence Public Library. Get information at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features, presenting Conclave, based on the novel, starring Ralph Fiennes, Stanley Tucci, John Lithgow, and Isabella Rossellini, directed by Edward Berger, in theaters everywhere today. From Linda Mood Bell Learning Centers, online instruction available anytime, anywhere for students to catch up or get ahead in reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodBell.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. In three swing states, Republican groups are challenging the votes of U.S. citizens living abroad, including U.S. military members. Many legal experts say these lawsuits likely won't succeed, but could lay the groundwork for questioning election results. Here's NPR voting rights correspondent Hanzi Lo Wong.
Before leaving the U.S. Army, retired Colonel Ray Kimball was an absentee ballot voter in Pennsylvania's elections.
No matter where I was serving, in the United States or overseas, I was confident that my absentee ballot vote was received and it was counted.
Federal law requires states like Pennsylvania to allow eligible military members and other U.S. citizens living abroad to vote in federal elections. And state election rules for overseas voting have been uncontroversial for years, until Republican groups filed three lawsuits.
This is directly challenging a fundamental right and franchise of my former colleagues, both military and civilian. And I'm tired of it.
Much ink has been spent by the secretary framing this lawsuit as anti-military or being antagonistic to our armed forces and their families. But nothing could be further from the truth.
Brandon Debus, an attorney for the Michigan Republican Party, spoke at a court hearing for the lawsuit against Michigan's Secretary of State.
If you are a Michigander and you are serving your country overseas, you are still a Michigander, and your vote is both proper and welcomed here.
Michigan's election rules also allow absentee voting by citizens who are born outside the U.S. and whose parent or legal guardian's former residence was in the state. But the Republican National Committee argues that violates Michigan's constitution, which requires voters to be residents. At the hearing, though, Michigan Judge Seema Patel pointed out that when it comes to voting, the state constitution allows lawmakers to define who is a resident.
How do you respond to defendants' argument that you've, in essence, disenfranchised an entire group of citizens who otherwise would be eligible to vote from being able to cast their vote anywhere in Michigan or in the United States?
Patel ultimately didn't get a convincing answer and dismissed the Michigan lawsuit, calling it an 11th-hour attempt to disenfranchise voters. In a similar case in North Carolina, a state judge rejected the RNC's request to set aside and not count some overseas voters' ballots. The RNC is appealing both rulings. In Pennsylvania, a federal judge is expected to rule soon in a lawsuit by a group of U.S. House Republicans. They're challenging how the state registers overseas voters.
What's kind of boggling about these lawsuits is that none of the systems that they are challenging about these voters are new.
Danielle Lang of the Campaign Legal Center helped file a court brief in support of Pennsylvania's election rules for overseas voters.
And yet these lawsuits were filed after the ballots already went out to these voters.
Many legal experts say the timing makes it likely that these lawsuits are going nowhere. Still, election watchers say these legal challenges may confuse voters and disrupt an already tense period for election workers in states like Pennsylvania, where the ballots of overseas voters can be received up to a week after Election Day.
It's a sort of ripe time for the intentional insertion of distrust and conspiracy theories.
Kathy Bookvar used to oversee elections in Pennsylvania.
Adding this doubt and intentional fueling of distrust is just another example of exactly what we don't need.
Overseas voters could play a key role in this close presidential race, where tens of thousands of votes could determine who wins a swing state like Pennsylvania, which has sent more than 25,000 absentee ballots abroad. Anzi Luong, NPR News.
It's Friday, time for StoryCorps. Halloween is Kate Heathcote's favorite holiday, but her husband David, who's from the UK, did not grow up celebrating it. Kate was eager for David to fully embrace his first spooky season in the US, so she convinced him to take a job at a professional haunted house.
I don't think I realized just what I was signing myself up for. I had to go for an audition, so I'm like, okay, this is professional. They don't take, you know, any Tom, Dick, or Harry. I remember turning up on my first day and, my goodness, I was a goblin monkey doorman. To be a goblin monkey, you have to start jumping around on the floor and using muscles that I'd just never used before, pouncing. And people don't get scared unless you fly at them. And then we added to that, you know, this loud pumping music with strobe lights.
I waited for so long for you that first night because they closed down kind of late. You just kind of wandered out, like in shock. Got you in the car, you sat down, and I think the radio was on. You're like, no, can it just be quiet?
I could hardly talk, and I was dehydrated, and I cried a little bit.
I definitely told you, you don't have to go back if you don't want to.
But I doubled down. I spent a lot of that month being zombie number one. Now, I remember this gaggle of schoolgirls, and then you hear one of them say, it's all models in here, there's no real people. And I launched myself out of my alcove. And the trouble is, they've all linked arms. So they just go down in this mass, and there's this mound of legs and arms and screams. And one of them said they'd wet themselves. And that is the ultimate win.
I realized that I had signed you up for something significantly harder than I ever anticipated. But you were willing to support me in what seemed like a crazy idea to you.
Well, actually, they did have Person of the Week, and I won that certificate twice.
Yes.
And they gave me free tickets, and I wanted you to go with me. You wouldn't go through.
I'm a big wuss. I love Halloween, but I don't like being scared. I guess I owe you a trip through it.
That sounds like a promise now. I've got you.
That was David and Kate Heathcote for StoryCorps. They sound adorable. I'm sorry. They just do. As of this airing, Kate has still not agreed to go through the haunted house with David. Their conversation is archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance. Dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com. And from Subaru. Subaru has donated more than $60 million to support the adoption, rescue, transport, and health of more than 504,000 animals. Learn more at subaru.com/pets.
This is NPR News.
Inflation has taken center stage this presidential election season. Both candidates promised to improve the economy for Americans, but are voters buying it?
I just know how it was when he was in office. Financially, I was much better.
I'm Elsa Chang, checking in with Pennsylvania voters and their pocketbooks on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is on the air from 3 to 7 today here on Kansas Public Radio. Join your host, Laura Lorson, for ATC, starting at 3.
This month's KPR Community Spotlights on Cherry Street Youth in Chanute, a Christian-based ministry formed to help develop children emotionally, spiritually, physically, and academically with after-school classes in gardening, cooking, art, and more. Details at cherrystreet.org.
A very fall-like day in store for us with sunshine, breezy conditions, and a high of 68. Right now, clear and 52 at KU.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Texas will be the focus of the race for the White House today when Vice President Harris and former President Donald Trump each travel to the Lone Star State. Harris is expected to focus on reproductive rights and the Texas abortion ban when she speaks at a rally in Houston. Trump is likely to emphasize security at the southern border and illegal immigration when he campaigns in Austin. Trump will also sit down with commentator Joe Rogan on his podcast. NPR's Franco Ordonez says Trump was in Las Vegas last night.
Donald Trump only spent a couple minutes directly addressing Asian American voters in an hour and a half speech in Las Vegas.
You are the greatest people, hardworking people, and we're going to take care of you. We're going to take care of you. You're going to take care of us.
While his speech largely tracked his recent stump speeches, the event was billed to celebrate the Asian American community and encourage voter participation. The Asian American community is the fastest growing segment of the electorate, and their political power is concentrated in key swing states like Nevada. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, Las Vegas.
Election day is now a week and a half away. Boeing says bringing back employee pensions is a non-starter as union machinists continue their strike against the company. This is NPR News from Washington.
And this is Kansas Public Radio News. I'm Jay Schaefer. Evergy says hundreds of customers across northeast Kansas remain without power this morning. Strong storms rolled through last night, knocking out power to about 4,000 homes in the Topeka area and another 500 homes in Jefferson County. As of this moment, 582 Evergy customers remain without power. The Kansas legislature's plan to consolidate the state's IT systems comes with some caveats. As Dylan Lyson tells us, a cybersecurity expert at KU says moving to a centralized system could expose the whole network during a cyber attack.
A new state law calls for consolidating the state's cybersecurity systems into a centralized structure over the next several years. Lawmakers want to beef up security, partly because of a hack on the state's court system last year. Alex Bardis is a computer scientist for the University of Kansas. He says a lot of hacks occur when attackers are able to slip into a system after a user with high-level access makes an error.
That user had a lot more privileges that they needed, and the attackers just take advantage of that.
BARDA says sensitive information and services need to be in modules within the centralized system so they can be closed off from one another when hacks occur. For the Kansas News Service, I'm Dylan Lyson in Overland Park.
In Kansas, Republican messaging on abortion is shifting somewhat as state lawmakers defend competitive seats in Johnson County.
Several GOP candidates have new sections on their websites with titles like Just the Facts and Setting the Record Straight. The near identical language on each of them says the candidates oppose a total abortion ban and support access to IVF treatment. Last session, State Senator Mike Thompson voted against debating a bill to protect IVF. But his site says he supports the right, and he views the issue as an empty talking point for Democrats.
The IVF thing is one of those straw man arguments they're trying to distract the public from actual policy discussions.
Thompson says his constituents in Shawnee care more about lowering income and property taxes. For the Kansas News Service, I'm Zane Irwin.
Officials are monitoring a drop in water levels at many Kansas lakes and reservoirs this fall. In some cases, the drop in water levels has revealed hidden dangers for boaters beneath the surface of the water, things like logs, sandbars, mudflats, and other hazards. Wildlife and parks officials recently warned boaters about these potential hazards. Lake levels at Cheney Reservoir have fallen nearly 9 feet. At Tunnel Creek near Manhattan, water levels have dropped around 5 feet over the past 2 months. A combination of dry conditions, drought, and little, if any, rain are blamed for the problem.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez, Culver City, California. The FBI is warning local and state officials that extremists with election grievances could turn to violence in the coming weeks. Election officials in swing states are particularly on edge, including in Georgia. So are voters there on both sides. Here's WABE's Sam Greenglass.
Gabe Sterling was fuming.
It has all gone too far.
By December 2020, Trump and his allies had been making false claims about election fraud for weeks. Sterling, a top deputy for Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, called a press conference.
It has to stop.
In one instance, two election workers faced so many threats they had to leave their homes and jobs.
And I think we're more prepared this time. What I'd get concerned about is some new tactic.
Sterling hopes one day this misinformation-soaked environment breaks, but it hasn't happened yet. Trump has so far declined to say he'll accept the results of this election. 4 years ago, talk of a stolen election, despite audits and recounts proving otherwise, propelled Daryl Kidd to Washington, D.C. on January 6, where a mob violently breached the Capitol. Outside a Trump rally in Atlanta, Kidd is wearing a Trump Save America hat. He says he didn't participate in any of the violence that day, but he did have doubts about the 2020 election.
This time, I think it's going to be more secure. In Georgia, anyway, I think it'll be more protected.
A controversial overhaul of Georgia election laws has given him confidence. But Kidd is less sure about other states. He says he would not rule out protesting the result again. Nearby, friends Tina McKay and Dory Walters are decked out in red and say they're processing more recent political violence, assassination attempts on Trump. I asked if that made them hesitant to attend.
I thought about it when it first happened. I thought, oh, how scary that would be. But when as soon as I was able to get a ticket here, I didn't think twice of it.
Yeah, I mean, I do fear for him because I do feel like he's got a huge target on his back.
The motives behind the attempts remain unclear. Walters and McKay say they blame Democrats, not Trump, for spiking the political temperature. Both campaigns have described their opponents as grave threats, but it is Trump who talks about bypassing Democratic norms and uses language laced with violent imagery and incendiary claims. Some of his harshest rhetoric has targeted immigrants.
I've been in this country 54 years. I did it the right way.
Daniela Usarin, who's from Uruguay, welcomes Trump's hardline stance. She says illegal immigration reflects poorly on immigrants like her. But what about Trump's false claims about legal migrants in Springfield, Ohio, eating pets?
As far as those issues in Ohio, I really can't say what's the reality.
The reality is that the claims are false, but the city still faces bomb threats. And for many immigrant communities, that is causing fear. At a Democratic canvassing kickoff at Peachy Corners Cafe, Trump's rhetoric is weighing on volunteers like Tamita Shamsuddin, who are picking up campaign flyers and Vietnamese coffee.
It's just dividing us even more with these non-truths and made-up stories.
Shamsuddin immigrated from Bangladesh nearly three decades ago.
And I never felt like I was anything less than, you know, because I got my education, got a job, and became, you know, what I hope is a contributing citizen. And it's personal for me, and it's hurtful.
Wearing a Harris Walz camo hat, Shamsuddin says she's committed to the campaign work. But knocking on strangers' doors to talk politics can be anxiety-inducing. In 2021, a shooter killed six women of Asian descent at spas around Atlanta. While the gunman hasn't been convicted of a hate crime, the incident made many Asian Americans fear they could be targeted. Volunteer Nathonia Adesti moved from Indonesia as a toddler. Whenever she passes one of the spas,
I always think about how, like, that could have been my dad, that could have been my mom, that could have been a family friend.
At a high top, Tavin is reading a comic book.
I'm a gun owner. Like, I want to vote Republican, but just the rhetoric towards immigrants has been something that has made me not want to vote Republican.
Vin came to the U.S. as a refugee from Cambodia in 1980. He remembers receiving a welcome basket. These days, he feels that spirit has faded, but the political climate has made him more resolved to go vote with his family.
Because we want to make it a big deal, all the kids together, and I want us as a family to, like, vote in a way that shows that we're part of this country.
Vin says he sees his vote as more than a choice for president. It's a way to assert he belongs in the country where he found refuge. For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Peachtree Corners, Georgia.
The streets of Peru's major cities are usually among the most congested and noisy in Latin America. Well, not this week. Bus drivers and others have launched a series of strikes over what they claim is government inaction against rampant extortion by criminal gangs. Simeon Tegel reports from Lima.
Shocked relatives lament the sudden death of Eduardo Carreño. He died when a hooded hitman boarded the minivan he was driving in Callao, the gritty port city abutting the Peruvian capital, Lima. The man shot Carreño and three passengers dead in retaliation, investigators believe, for the driver refusing to pay extortion. And so, for the third time in a month, angry transport workers took to the streets on Wednesday to vent their frustrations in protest at the violent crime wave that has cost the lives of around 20 drivers in recent months.
We are at a point where we are paying the results of bad governments and irresponsible governance in Peru.
Antonio Maldonado, a former anti-corruption prosecutor. Like many, he believes that recent counter-reforms passed by lawmakers have actually encouraged the criminals.
Congress was so irresponsible, not only with this law, but also with other laws that were made with the only purpose to serve to the members of the Congress that are linked to organized crime or that are being investigated for public corruption.
They include measures to stop the police seizing illegal explosives, ban surprise raids on suspects' homes, and curb prosecutors' powers to investigate extortion, corruption, and human trafficking. The measures come amid a series of attacks by the deeply unpopular Congress on the judiciary and the electoral system that many warn amount to an assault on Peru's fragile democracy and has most ordinary Peruvians demanding new elections.
Los servicios de dicha institución se han brindado con absoluta normalidad.
Prime Minister Gustavo Adriansen played down the impact of Wednesday's strike, but unless his government rescinds recent laws and takes effective action against the extortionists, more stoppages are planned. For NPR News, this is Simeon Tegel in Lima, Peru.
Monday on Morning Edition, our Stress Less series continues. We'll hear about a strategy that may help you get to the root of your stress and understand yourself better. Listen on the NPR app or your local station. This is NPR News.
Your place to find NPR News, it's Kansas Public Radio. Well, we've been talking about it and talking about it. Now it's finally here. KPR's Live Day kicks off at 9 o'clock this morning. with music from the Midwest Chamber Ensemble of Kansas City, playing trio music for piano, cello, and French horn. Around 10 o'clock this morning, we'll head over to the Kansas, the Lawrence Public Library around 10 a.m. as we listen to music from the Bluestem Wind Ensemble and some great classical saxophone music. These particular musicians are all from Washburn in the 10 o'clock hour. So Live Day kicks off at 9 o'clock this morning. It'll be a day filled with live classical music performances from the KPR studio and from the Lawrence Public Library. Don't forget about the special spooky concert at the library tonight, 7 o'clock. KPR classical music host Destiny and some of her friends will bring us some spooky sounds at the library. That's at 7 o'clock tonight. You're invited. It's free and fun and very festive. We hope to see you there. Clear skies, 51 degrees. It's going to be sunny and breezy today with a high of 68.
Join me, Nick Carswell, this Saturday at 5 p.m. for 105 Live, where we continue our quest to bring you the best new, original, and noteworthy music being made all across the state of Kansas. This week's show includes artists from Wichita, Manhattan, Lawrence, and Kansas City, and our live session comes from the stage of the Bottleneck with Eddie Moore's Electric Group. That's 105 Live this Saturday at 5 p.m. on Kansas Public Radio.
Good morning, me Martinez. A velvet voice crooner has passed away. Two-time Grammy winner Jack Jones was one of the leaders of the easy listening genre in the 1960s. He had three Billboard number one hits during the decade and was the iconic voice on the theme song, the late 70s, early 80s sitcom, The Love Boat. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. The World Series starts tonight in Los Angeles. The Dodgers versus the New York Yankees. Two iconic big city teams with some of baseball's biggest stars. Now, the Yankees have players such as Aaron Judge and Juan Soto, but no one is bigger today than the Dodgers' Shohei Ohtani, who has crushed all expectations in his first season on the team. Here's Steve Futterman.
This was probably the most transformative moment for the 2024 baseball season.
There's once in a lifetime, and then there's once in forever when you get a ball player like this. Shohei Ohtani is a Los Angeles Dodger.
The Dodgers play-by-play announcer Joe Davis making the formal announcement of Shohei Ohtani's arrival. Ohtani's year with the Dodgers has been nothing short of phenomenal. The biggest moment came last month when he became the first ever to hit 50 home runs and steal 50 bases in the same season.
Ohtani sends one in the air, the other way, back it goes, gone! One-of-a-kind player, one-of-a-kind season, Shohei Ohtani starts the 50-50 club!
The only blip for Ohtani this year happened off the field, not on it.
What I have stated clearly from the outset of this investigation to the announcement of this complaint is that Mr. Ohtani is considered a victim in this case. He did not profit from this. He did not benefit from this.
That's U.S. Attorney Martin Estrada. Just days into the season, Ohtani's longtime interpreter and close friend, Ipe Mizuhara, was accused of stealing millions of dollars from Ohtani to pay off gambling debts. The interpreter pleaded guilty and could spend decades in prison. Except for that, this has been almost a perfect season for Ohtani. Los Angeles seems to have fallen in love with him. And nowhere is that more apparent than L.A.'s Little Tokyo neighborhood, Ohtani's face is everywhere.
He's our treasure.
Treasure?
Yeah, our treasure. We are, you know, we enjoy watching him every single day.
Nikki Akeda runs a gift shop in Little Tokyo. She had never been to a baseball game before this season. Now she's gone full Ohtani.
I never watched game. I never interested in game in my life. But from this year, I very much into. I got the season ticket from this year.
You got season tickets?
Yeah, yeah. I already purchased next year 2025 season ticket already.
Among his teammates, Ohtani is incredibly popular. Last week, as the Dodgers were celebrating winning the National League Championship, infielder Max Muncy said Ohtani has done everything right.
He's the world's biggest baseball star, not just the game, the world. He shows up every day. You expect him to do something incredible, and he very rarely disappoints. He goes out there and he does something incredible almost every single night.
Now, of course, there's that little thing called the World Series. The Dodgers still have to win four games. And the Yankees know Ohtani could play a huge role. New York's top star Aaron Judge is a big fan.
Hits for average, hits for power, the speed. He's an impressive athlete, you know, the best player in the game, and you know, what an ambassador for this sport.
As Game 1 begins tonight, the biggest spotlight, as usual, will be on Shohei Ohtani. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Jay Schaefer. Thanks for tuning in to Kansas Public Radio this morning.
Support for KPR comes from the Lawrence Farmers Market, accepting credit, debit, or SNAP cards in exchange for tokens. Multiple double-up programs available to match SNAP dollars. Learn more at the Market Info booth Saturday mornings at 824 New Hampshire.
Our annual live day kicks off on KPR 1 at 9 o'clock this morning. But I want to remind you about how we will conclude live day. A special free concert tonight, a Halloween-themed concert with KPR evening classical host and violinist Destiny. Destiny Ann Mermagan and her friends will put on a great show this evening at 7 o'clock at the Lawrence Public Library Auditorium, and you are invited. It's just one part of Live Day, classical music all day long on KPR 1 stations, starting at 9 a.m.
Support for KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello. Sunday, November 3rd, 2 p.m. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu.
Up next is the latest business news on the Marketplace Morning Report. And in less than 10 minutes, we'll bring you a summary of news headlines from across the planet and around the state. Clear skies right now in Lawrence, where it's 51 degrees.
Support for KPR comes from the Midwest Chamber Ensemble, featuring trios for horn, cello, and piano, 4 p.m. Sunday at Lutheran Church of the Resurrection in Prairie Village, Kansas. Details at MidwestChamberEnsemble.org.
The case for getting on-the-job training in how to be a person.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Learn more at templeton.org. And by Rubrik. When cyber attacks put businesses at risk, Rubrik provides the power to bounce back fast. More at Rubrik.com.
Yep, supply and demand.
Indeed. First, the four biggest U.S.-based airlines have all reported summer into fall results now, and the theme emerges, passengers should brace themselves for higher fares over the coming months. That's in part because airlines are offered fewer seats for sale. Even as demand for year-end travel could be strong, a demand meets less supply play. Marketplace's anxious Novosapo is here with more.
Yep, supply and demand. There was a period over the summer, David, when airlines had too many seats on offer and not enough passengers that led to airfares declining. The industry corrected itself. It cut back on how many seats are available for sale on domestic flights, and that's bearing fruit. Fares are up. American and Southwest yesterday both surprised with relatively cheery results. American said third quarter sales were up and it lifted its forecast for annual profits. Southwest eked out a surprise profit of $90 million. And we've already heard from United and Delta. They both reported strong revenues as well.
There's news regulators in Washington will look into the state of competition among airlines. These revenues and profits will factor in, I would imagine.
Well, certainly if you're thinking public relations, cheery earnings reports from airlines right now may not help them. And yes, the Justice and Transportation Departments are asking for public comments about consolidation and the availability and affordability of air travel. Comments can be submitted through the website regulations.gov until December 23. Now, the industry trade group Airlines for America responded to this saying that questioning whether the timing is of this federal inquiry might be politically motivated coming so close to the election, David.
Is there an election? No. While human skills like adaptability, leadership, and communication overwhelmingly scored as vital in a new Deloitte survey, one in three employees says they have limited or no human skills training. We get cyber training, but what about a little something more about dealing with people? Here's Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall.
In the survey, nearly all respondents said human skills are timeless. Nearly 90% said human skills help them get ahead. And yet, technology is where a lot of firms are investing in their employees. Deloitte's Anthony Stefan.
The future is dependent on a very clearly defined yes and strategy. Yes, we must invest in technical skills to continue to allow our people to create differentiated opportunity in the marketplace. And yes, we need to invest in human skills.
Even though human skills have been getting more attention over the years, many organizations are holding back.
I think a lot of it is time and budget.
Claudia Magallan is a workforce development expert in Texas.
Especially when you're working for small agencies or nonprofit agencies, you have to do as much as you can with the budget you have. How do you get people out of a classroom or away from cases and stuff like that to attend a training? It has to be very calculated.
And budgets for training and development can be quite constrained, says consultant Eliyahu Lotsar with Reframed Reality.
Honestly, the bottom line problem is that HR doesn't really have a seat at the table with the big players.
He says executive decisions tend to focus on short-term necessity.
The fact that there's somebody in HR waving a flag saying, hey, we need to invest in the long run. People don't develop as fast as, this little marketplace advantage you're going to get if you implement this new software.
He says while technology is making us more productive so we can feel accomplished,
we need to have social recognition. And things are just getting much more intense.
He says in the economic times we're in today, technology can be at odds with a critical piece of workplace fulfillment, relationships. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Markets, S&P futures are up 0.4%. I see NASDAQ futures up 0.5%. Crude oil is up 1%, under 71 a barrel now. In 2005, 4 years after the September 11th attacks, federal law directed an upgrade in the identification needed to get on an airplane. It's the so-called real IDs, those signs that airports have been warning about for 4 years. There's news the Transportation Department is sticking with the real ID deadline of May 7th of this next year, but not exactly. Now the deadline will be squishy until sometime in the year 2027. People without the enhanced ID may just get warnings and still allowed on the plane. Get a real ID before the rush or face extra hassle is the takeaway.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by C3 Generative AI. C3 Generative AI enables rapid access to secure, traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems, all while using any LLM, helping enterprises turn the invisible into the obvious. C3.AI. This is Enterprise AI. And by the Financial Times, whose pink pages fearlessly report on U.S. politics from a global perspective. There's more at FT.com. And by Amazon Business, focused on offering smart business buying solutions, leaving time to focus on growth. More at AmazonBusiness.com.
We've been talking to winners of this month's Nobel Economics Prize, three scholars who studied how institutions like an inclusive democracy contribute to a country's prosperity. So then what explains the success of China, autocratically ruled by leaders who brook no dissent? I ran this past James Robinson of the University of Chicago, who, with one of the other Nobel laureates, is author of the book Why Nations Fail. Here's a clip.
The economic development of China since the late 1970s has, you know, has happened because of this move from what we call extractive to much more inclusive economic institutions. That's exactly what our theory would predict, that the tricky thing, as you're saying, is that they've kept these extractive political institutions. I think what we say in Why Nations Fail, which I still believe, is that this is not sustainable. You know, you can't have a modern, innovative, inclusive economy at the whim of a totalitarian political system. You know, when I'm old enough to remember when the Soviet Union was held up as an example of successful economic growth. Of course, there's lots of things that are different about the Chinese case. But I think if you look at history, that's got to be the right picture.
Robinson also spoke about how the U.S. economy fails most people and draws a line between this and diminished faith in American democracy now. All of that is streamable from the Marketplace homepage now. Our executive producer is Kelly Silvera, digital producer Jarrett Dang. Today, our engineers are Brian Allison and John Brewington. I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
If you've got an old car that won't make it through another Kansas winter, KPR's vehicle donation program can help. We turn your donated vehicle into the programs you enjoy every day. Donate your car online at kansaspublicradio.org.
It's almost 8 o'clock on this Friday morning. We are about an hour away from KPR's annual Live Day. So we hope you'll stick around for classical music performed live here at the radio station and over at the Lawrence Public Library. This is Kansas Public Radio, which includes KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, and KANQ Chanute. Sunny and 51 degrees on the KU campus in Lawrence. It'll be May with a high of 68.
Good morning. Would Donald Trump really use the military for retribution against perceived political rivals or to round up and deport migrants? I'll ask Trump's former Defense Secretary Mark Esper in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. A peek behind the scenes of a high-stakes election that'll decide the leader of one of the most powerful, influential organizations in the world. I mean, Martinez, that is what the new film Conclave is about. I'll speak to the star of the movie, Ray Fiennes. Also, President Joe Biden is in Arizona today to apologize to Native Americans for the government's role in forcing indigenous children into boarding schools. It's Friday, October 25th. Game one of the World Series is tonight, and it's also Yankee superstar slugger Juan Soto's 26th birthday. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The presidential candidates will both campaign in Texas today. Former President Donald Trump will stump with Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz. Vice President Harris will campaign with Cruz's opponent, Democratic Congressman Colin Allred, and music icon Beyonce. Harris continues to criticize Trump for alleged comments he made praising Hitler. These comments were first reported by The Atlantic. Campaigning in Atlanta last night, Harris says the alleged comments are disturbing.
Take a moment to think about what that means. That Trump said, quote, Hitler did some good things. And that Trump wished he had generals like Hitler's, who would be loyal to Trump and not to America's Constitution.
Trump is vehemently denying the comments published by The Atlantic. He told Fox News that the reporter made up the story.
He made a statement that I'm like Hitler. It just couldn't be further from the truth. It's just the opposite, actually.
Trump has previously praised dictators and said if elected, he would deploy armed forces against American protesters and political opponents. The high cost of housing is a factor for many U.S. voters in this election. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports that's very true in key swing states, such as in the Sun Belt.
Casey Dawkins is a professor of urban studies and planning at the University of Maryland. The candidates have different approaches when it comes to easing the high cost of housing, but he says they're putting forth some similar ideas.
They're both mentioning the importance of trying to incentivize local governments to adopt more innovative regulatory practices and to sort of remove the regulatory restrictions on housing. They both mentioned that. Both mentioned sort of opening up federal lands to housing construction.
Demand for housing continues to outpace supply in the U.S., driving up prices. Many Gen Z voters in particular say home ownership is currently out of their reach. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
An Ohio judge has struck down the state's abortion ban as unconstitutional. From Ohio Public Media, Sarah Donaldson reports Ohio voters enshrined abortion rights in the state constitution.
Passed in 2019 and called the heartbeat bill by its backers, the Ohio law would ban abortion procedures statewide after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. Now that law's been permanently blocked by a county judge who writes, quote, "The state cannot properly undermine this right to an abortion." Advocates call it a momentous ruling, but Gabe Mann with the group Abortion Forward says there's still work to be done.
We're absolutely looking to see if it gets appealed, and we've been talking to voters about that this entire year.
Anti-abortion groups call the amendment to enshrine access to the procedure extreme and harmful. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Donaldson in Columbus, Ohio.
This is NPR.
And this is Kansas Public Radio News. Good morning, I'm Jay Schaefer. It's 8:04. Severe storms knocked out power to thousands across northeast Kansas last night. About 4,000 homes in the Topeka area lost electricity, and another 500 homes were hit in Jefferson County. As of this hour, about 564 customers remain without power this morning. Two people have been injured in southeast Kansas after a car collided with a horse and buggy. The Highway Patrol says the collision took place Thursday morning near Parsons. Troopers say the horse and buggy was halfway in the outside lane and on the shoulder when it was struck in the rear by a vehicle. KSNT reports that the buggy driver, a 35-year-old woman from Cherryvale, was seriously injured. So was her passenger, a 16-year-old girl. They were both taken to Labette County Health in Parsons. Their condition is unknown. The driver of the car, a 27-year-old woman from Neodesha, was uninjured. The Kansas legislature's plan to consolidate the state's IT systems comes with some caveats. As Dylan Lyson reports, a cybersecurity expert at KU says moving to a centralized system could expose the entire network during a hack.
A new state law calls for consolidating the state's cybersecurity systems into a centralized structure over the next several years. Lawmakers want to beef up security, partly because of a hack on the state's court system last year. Alex Bardis is a computer scientist for the University of Kansas. He says a lot of hacks occur when attackers are able to slip into a system after a user with high-level access makes an error.
That user had a lot more privileges that they needed, and the attackers just take advantage of that.
Barda says sensitive information and services need to be in modules within the centralized system so they can be closed off from one another when hacks occur. For the Kansas News Service, I'm Dylan Lyson in Overland Park.
The 16th-ranked K-State Wildcats are still in the running for a Big 12 championship, but they are hoping to avoid a stumble at 7 o'clock tomorrow night in Manhattan against the KU Jayhawks.
Only BYU and Iowa State remain unbeaten in the Big 12, both with 4-0 conference records and 7-0 overall. But the Wildcats are tied with three other teams with 3-1 conference records. The Wildcats have beaten KU 15 straight times, but Wildcats coach Chris Kleiman says he had no plans to bring up the topic.
The last few years have been really competitive games, and we've found a way. Last year we were down 11 in the second half and found a way.
KU enters the game with an overall record of 2-5 and won its first conference game last weekend against Houston. I'm Greg Eklund.
And in men's college basketball, a high-profile charity exhibition game gets underway tonight between the top-ranked Kansas Jayhawks and the Arkansas Razorbacks. The Jayhawks, ranked number one, are expected to play before a sold-out crowd at 8 o'clock tonight in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Sunny and breezy weather today. We'll have a high of 68. This is KPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. Former President Donald Trump has threatened to use the military against his political opponents if he's reelected. We'll hear from his former Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, who disagreed with Trump when he tried to deploy the National Guard against Black Lives Matter protesters. First, though, with less than 2 weeks left until Election Day, both presidential candidates are racing around the seven swing states. Today, they're both in Texas, one of the reddest states in the country. Trump has a big interview lined up, and Vice President Harris is trying to put abortion rights back in the spotlight. NPR's Deepa Shivaram is in Houston with the vice president. So, Deepa, why the Lone Star State?
Well, honestly, polls show that there's a huge gender divide in this campaign. Women favor Harris and men favoring Trump. And today's Texas stop kind of highlights that. Trump is taping the Joe Rogan podcast in Austin, which is a podcast that's very popular with young men. And it's a demographic he's trying to get out the vote with. Meanwhile, Harris is in Houston. She's taping a podcast with Brene Brown. It's popular among women. And this is Beyonce's hometown, and Beyonce is going to perform at the rally tonight for Harris. So a lot of things going on, but I will say it's more than Beyonce in this final stretch of the campaign. Harris is trying to bring her message on reproductive rights back into the forefront, and Texas has had some of the most restrictive abortion bans in the country. There are several women from Texas who, during this campaign, have shared their stories in speeches and ads of being denied an abortion when they needed them, which has put their lives at risk.
And how effective have those ads been?
You know, there is a new ad out this week, and I will say it's pretty memorable. It features a woman in Texas who was denied care when she had a miscarriage, and it shows a scar that she had from the emergency surgery that goes all the way down her entire chest, down to her stomach. And because of what happened, she may never be able to have children. It's the kind of image that it sticks in your head, you know, to show the impact of the Supreme Court decision. And the audio in the background of the ad is Trump saying he's going to be a, quote, protector of women. So this is definitely a topic that Democrats want to reignite attention on and make sure it's top of mind for voters.
Right. And reproductive rights have really been a big focus in the Senate race that's going on in Texas right now. That's Democratic Congressman Colin Allred challenging incumbent Senator Ted Cruz. Do Democrats maybe see this as a Senate seat that they can flip?
You know, as tight as this presidential race is, the race over who will control Congress is also really tight. And Texas has long been a red state. It's been 30 years since there was last a Democratic senator. I spoke with Brandon Rodinghouse. He's a professor of politics at the University of Houston. And he says the changing demographics in Texas in the last several years could maybe change things this time around.
The population has been surging with people moving here, and it's made the state much younger and much more racially and ethnically diverse. So it's really changing the dynamic of what Texas is politically.
And, you know, Allred has made reproductive rights a major focus in his campaign, and it's become a liability for Cruz in this race, as Allred has hammered him on this issue. So this visit from Harris is pretty significant. She's a candidate who's short on time here, and for her to fly out to Houston and campaign with Allred shows that Democrats think they have a decent shot to flip this race.
All right, so where are Trump and Harris heading to next?
So last night I was with her as she rallied with Barack Obama in Atlanta. It was her biggest rally yet. There were about 20,000 people there. Tomorrow she heads to Kalamazoo, Michigan for a rally with Michelle Obama. Trump is headed to Michigan next as well. He has stops in Traverse City and then the Detroit suburbs. And both candidates will be in Pennsylvania this weekend too, going after those undecided voters and trying to drum up support from their bases.
Feels like the final turn of a very long race, right? NPR's Deepa Shivaram, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
A number of former aides to President Trump worry about how he might use the military if he's reelected. That's because he's repeatedly said things like what he told Fox's Maria Bartiromo earlier this month.
I think the bigger problem are the people from within. We have some very bad people. We have some sick people, radical left lunatics. And I think they're the big, and it should be very easily handled by, if necessary, by National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military.
During the summer of 2020, Trump wanted to use active duty troops to quell Black Lives Matter demonstrations. His then Defense Secretary, Mark Esper, disagreed with him. Here's Esper speaking at the Pentagon that June.
The option to use active duty forces in a law enforcement role should only be used as a matter of last resort and only in the most urgent and dire of situations. We are not in one of those situations now.
Esper says he stayed on the job as long as he could until Trump fired him that November. I spoke to the former defense secretary yesterday, and I asked him about how he remembers his interactions with Trump during those turbulent months of 2020. We understand that after you said that, Mark Meadows called and screamed at you. I mean, really laid into you, expletives flying. And then at the White House, Donald Trump did the same thing. I mean, what was going on in your head when that was happening, when you were getting that kind of response to what you said?
I'd have to go back into my memoir and see exactly how I wrote it. And what I said at the Pentagon, which I think is what you're referring to, is I stood before the American public at the podium and said that there is no need for American troops unless it's something like in the most urgent and dire of circumstances, right? Because we have deployed federal troops in the past in certain situations at the request of the governors, though, and you think about the times of segregation. But in this circumstance, when the discussion within the Oval Office 2 days earlier was about using active duty troops to put down protests, peaceful protests, I thought that clearly crossed the line. And to me, that was the issue at hand. And that's why I felt, because as I wrote in my memoir, over the preceding 2 days, tensions continue to escalate in the country. More protests were breaking out in cities. And of course, now there was this shadow of the United States military being deployed. And I felt at the need, a day and a half later, on the morning of June 3rd, I believe, to go out publicly and say, I do not support invocation of the Insurrection Act.
Now, I was listening to an interview that you did a few years ago with my colleague, Michelle Martin, and you said that when Donald Trump asked, why can't you just shoot them in the leg, that it was a suggestion in the form of a question. That's how you describe it. Why do you think he didn't just make it an actual presidential order?
That tended to be his style, was to kind of talk in terms of suggestions, or wouldn't it be great if somebody did this? Or he was reluctant to give orders for some reason. But I think he was trying to take the temperature of the audience to see if there would be receptivity. And, you know, when he said that, we were all stunned, particularly General Mark Milley and myself, who were he was the ones we were principally talking to at that point in time.
Secretary, what do you think would have happened if Donald Trump had indeed made that an order?
Well, in this case, to deploy paratroopers into the streets of Washington, D.C., the worst of the worst would be that you would see active duty troops in the streets. Again, in the worst case scenario, they would be armed. And in the worst case scenario, like we saw at Kent State, they would fire their weapons. And I can say that with some credibility, because I was a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne stationed in Europe. I understand the military ethic. I understand the nature of the Army, and I understand our history as well. And to me, there were a number of really bad outcomes, not least of which what would happen on the scene to peaceful protesters, or even protesters who weren't peaceful but who were violent. You had that immediate negative of people getting shot, possibly killed, and what that means. You obviously would have a crisis within the government, given the fact that active duty troops were deployed in the streets of Washington, D.C.
You mentioned maybe a situation where it's urgent and dire. What would that mean? Give us a picture of what that would look like, where an urgent and dire situation would call for this.
Well, you could look back through our history, or you could just imagine situations. I mean, the Insurrection Act was about putting down insurrections or rebellion. So if you really literally had an armed rebellion that neither law enforcement, and this is how I thought through the process, law enforcement, either local or state, or federal law enforcement, or the National Guard couldn't put down or control, that's when there is a role for active duty troops in that scenario.
In 1968, black service members refused to arrest people at the Chicago Democratic National Convention. Five dozen service members from Fort Hood were court-martialed. My colleague Tom Bowman talked to a retired senior U.S. official who said that if an administration used active military to deport migrants, that it could break the military. Secretary, do you see a similar scenario that you would be concerned about if that was something that an administration wanted to do when it comes to migrants?
I don't believe that the active duty military can be used to round up illegal persons in the country and deport them, if you will. I think it violates the Posse Comitatus Act, which basically restricts the U.S. military, the active duty military, from performing policing actions within the United States. And so there are some exceptions here and there, but they're very specific. So I don't believe that authority exists. But I'm not a lawyer, and I think it's something that needs to be looked at.
How concerned are you that if Donald Trump were to have a second administration, that he would not surround himself with people like you that would push back, that he would have people that would encourage him to act out on these impulses, these inclinations, as you call them?
My concern has always been in a second term that Trump and those around him learned the lesson that you have to get the right people, and people who will be loyal to you and what you want to do in your policies, people who aren't necessarily loyal to the Constitution, but to the president. And it's a big distinction. It's certainly a significant one when it comes to the oath of office to the Constitution that we all swear, but particularly the military.
Secretary, do you agree with John Kelly, Trump's former chief of staff and a former Marine general, who has said that Trump meets the definition of a fascist and, quote, prefers the dictator approach to government?
You know, I've said what's the terrible thing that's happened over the last several years is the public discourse has gotten too angry, too mean. There's too much name-calling, ad hominem attacks, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not going to put labels on this right now. But what I said the other day was this. If you go open up the dictionary and look at how fascism or a fascist is described, there's certain elements. And as you pick through that, you can't help but see where John Kelly's coming from and agree with some of the descriptions. And so I think each person should make their own judgment. I'm concerned, and I've put my caution out there to others as a warning.
That's former Defense Secretary Mark Esper. Secretary, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Support for KPR comes from River Rat Print and Skate, a local source for custom screen printing and apparel decorating, including t-shirts, sweatshirts, workwear, and more. Available for school fundraisers and other events. Details at their location in North Lawrence or riverratks.com.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Kansas Public Radio. 8:19 on this Friday morning. We hope you'll stay with us today for Live Day on KPR One.
Support for KPR comes from Stoneback Appliance, 9th and Iowa in Lawrence. Locally owned and operated with over 50 years of sales and repairs. We've got your back at StonebackAppliance.com.
What do you mean you haven't heard of Live Day? Every year KPR puts on Live Day. This is where we have classical music performed live throughout the day. And coming up on KPR at 9 o'clock this morning, we will kick things off with music from the Midwest Chamber Ensemble of Kansas City. They'll be playing trio music for piano, cello, and French horn from our live performance studio. And then in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll go live from the Lawrence Public Library for the Blue Stem Wind Ensemble, plus some great classical saxophone music. These particular musicians in the 10 o'clock hour are all from Washburn University. So that's how Live Day will begin this year. And we'll have music live throughout the day from KPR and from the public library. Don't forget, 7 o'clock tonight, we've got a free concert at the library featuring our very own classical music evening announcer, Destiny, who also plays a mean violin. Her concert starts at 7 o'clock tonight at the Lawrence Public Library. She'll bring along some friends. And tonight's concert at 7 o'clock at the library will be somewhat Halloween-themed. So we hope to see you there. In fact, if I can get a nap this afternoon, I'm going to be there. A great concert tonight, 7 o'clock at the library in Lawrence with Destiny, classical cowgirl, who plays some spooky tunes. A very sunny and fall-like day in store for us with a high of 68 degrees. Tomorrow's sunny and a high of 66. Right now it's sunny and 52 at KU.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. If fiction depicts reality, then the election of a pope can be cutthroat. At least that's how it's portrayed in the new movie Conclave. In the opening scene, the pope is dead. His room is sealed. Cardinals from all over the world meet to select the next one. Ralph Fiennes plays Thomas Lawrence, Dean of the College of Cardinals.
when the conclave begins and all the cardinals have arrived in the Vatican, they are sequestered. They have to be uninfluenced by outside events or people. And that is one of the key things. They are cut off.
Fine's character is in charge of managing the vote and the strong and various opinions about the future of the church. In a powerful monologue, Cardinal Lawrence offers a homily.
Cari fratelli in Cristo.
As she starts the sermon in quite a sort of bland way, as if he will say sort of unsurprising elements about how we remember our Holy Father, how we wish the conclave will choose another worthy figure, blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly he stops.
But you know all that. Let me speak from the heart for a moment.
And he talks about the value of doubt.
Our faith is a living thing precisely because it walks hand in hand with doubt. If there was only certainty and no doubt, there would be no mystery and therefore no need for faith.
It's quite a sophisticated philosophical proposal, I think. But I think I interpret it as being, we have to be open. We cannot lock ourselves rigidly into rules and dogma or doctrine in which we are not allowed to question. And I think he says this partly because of his own inner state, but also we understand he is allied to the figure of Cardinal Bellini. This is the cardinal played by Stanley Tucci, and he is the leading liberal candidate in the conclave. And being his ally, he is therefore saying, if the church is to modernize, it has to question some of its sort of fixed beliefs or fixed rules.
Let's hear that clip. That is when you're talking to Stanley Tucci's character, because among the front runners for the papacy, an American with liberal views, that's played by Stanley Tucci, and then a conservative Italian who wants to take the church back into a very pre-Vatican II direction. So that's the current riff in the Catholic Church personified in these two men. Let's hear this.
Have you seen the papers? Mm-hmm. Apparently it's already decided it's to be me.
And I happen to agree with them.
What if I don't want it? No sane man would want the papacy.
Some of our colleagues seem to want it.
What if I know in my heart that I am not worthy?
You are more worthy than any of us.
I'm not.
Well, then tell your supporters not to vote for you, to pass the chalice.
And let it go to him? I could never live with myself.
So no sane man would want the papacy. I guess part of this is to talk about ambition, right? And what does that mean when someone is seeking leadership? I mean, is ambition a red flag when it comes to a job as powerful and as important as the Pope?
I don't know. I mean, where ambition becomes egocentric and self-serving is one thing. Where it is simply an ambition because you have a vision for a better church, I think these things one could debate endlessly. I think it's okay to be ambitious for something. I do think Stanley's character is, we understand he's ambitious, but I don't think he's ambitious for a self-aggrandizing way. It's not just about stopping Tedesco, it's also about advancing or bringing the church into the issues of sexual orientation, gender, women. Key liberal issues is what I think Stanley's character is advocating.
How much experience did you have or have you had in your life with the Catholic Church? Just wondering, considering how you played this role, if you had any experience with Catholicism.
I was brought up Catholic. My mother was a committed Catholic until I was about 13 when I rebelled. I said to my mother, I don't want to go to Mass anymore. I don't understand it. I don't feel it. I don't believe. This was in Ireland. We lived for a little time in Ireland, which at that time in the early 70s, the reach of the church into everyday life was very strong. But despite that, I've always carried in my adult life a real curiosity about a faith and a real interest in people who are committed to a life in the church.
Did you wind up spending any time in Rome with Vatican insiders to maybe study how the dean of the College of the Cardinals carries out their duties?
Yes, I did. I met some priests who were incredibly helpful, and they're thinkers. They're big thinkers, the people I met anyway. They're thinking philosophically a lot about these big questions. They're not. I didn't meet anyone who I felt was locked in defensively in relation to here's an actor playing a cardinal. I met open and kind people, actually, who said, yes, these are challenges. I found it quite inspirational because I didn't ever come across someone who said, oh, you know, this shouldn't happen.
Now, eventually the Cardinals do elect a pope, and this is where the film has quite a twist
as an ending. It's in the book, but and I won't spoil the film right here. But in American politics, it would be as if an October surprise came after the election in November, after a decision was already made. Ray, that ending and the way it played out, is it meant to challenge people and the way they come up with a choice where if new information comes in later, they're still good with their choice?
That's a good question. I mean, Lawrence is the man faced with this choice. I think he has the power to rescind the choice if he feels that the person that's been chosen doesn't tick all the required boxes. Yeah. And he encounters quite a complex question. The Pope has been elected, but he learns X, Y, Z. And I think it's handled with real sensitivity. In fact, it's saying the humanity of the person isn't in doubt, or the spiritual depth of the figure elected is not in question. This ambiguity is something Lawrence can live with. I think he's moved by what he learns about the new Pope. There's a revelation, and at its essence, it is ambiguity.
That is Ray Fiennes. He's the star of the new film, Conclave. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, A. Good talking to you.
This is NPR News.
Inflation has taken center stage this presidential election season. Both candidates promised to improve the economy for Americans, but are voters buying it?
I just know how it was when he was in office. Financially, I was much better.
I'm Elsa Chang, checking in with Pennsylvania voters and their pocketbooks on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us at 3 o'clock this afternoon for All Things Considered on KPR. Laura Lorson will be your host from 3 to 7 today on KPR. Sunny skies, 52 degrees here. It'll be sunny all day long. We'll warm up to around 68 this afternoon.
Support for KPR comes from the Lead Center, hosting comedian Lewis Black in Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, the final tour, Saturday, November 2nd, 7:30 p.m. Tickets are available at lead.ku.edu.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The presidential race goes through Texas today. Vice President Harris is holding a rally in Houston, where she is expected to focus on reproductive rights and the state's abortion ban. Former President Donald Trump is traveling to Austin. That's where he's likely to highlight security and illegal immigration at the U.S. southern border. Election Day in November is a week from Tuesday. President Biden is traveling to Arizona today, where he's expected to issue an apology to Native Americans on behalf of the federal government. NPR's Jimena Bustillo has more.
While visiting the Gila River Indian community, Biden is expected to issue a formal apology for the federal government's Native American boarding school program. Between 1819 and 1969, the federal government operated more than 400 boarding schools across the country. The goal was complete assimilation. It is estimated that almost 1,000 students died, possibly more, and many more suffered physical abuse, neglect, and stripping of their languages and culture. This would be the first public apology issued by a U.S. president. The visit to Gila River also comes less than 2 weeks before Election Day. The reservation sits within Maricopa County, one of the counties that could determine control of the White House. Native voting advocates say tribal voters in Arizona could make a difference in this year's results. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News from Washington.
And this is KPR News. Good morning, I'm Jay Schaefer. Utility company Evergy says a line of storms moved across Kansas and into Missouri last night, starting around 7 p.m., which resulted in roughly 17,000 outages at its peak. As of this morning, power has been restored to all but about 600 customers. The Kansas City metro area is expected to be cleaned up early this morning, with a majority of events being assigned and worked on. Topeka was hit particularly hard by the storm. Crews are working on some remaining outages in the capital city. Evergy crews worked overnight and into the morning, and they say that full power restoration should be achieved by 4 o'clock this afternoon, with most customers being restored by noon today. In Kansas, Republican messaging on abortion is shifting as state lawmakers defend competitive seats in Johnson County.
Several GOP candidates have new sections on their websites with titles like Just the Facts and Setting the Record Straight. The near identical language on each of them says the candidates oppose a total abortion ban and support access to IVF treatment. Last session, State Senator Mike Thompson voted against debating a bill to protect IVF. But his site says he supports the right, and he views the issue as an empty talking point for Democrats.
The IVF thing is one of those straw man arguments they're trying to distract the public from actual policy discussions.
Thompson says his constituents in Shawnee care more about lowering income and property taxes. For the Kansas News Service, I'm Zane Irwin.
Federal and state officials are monitoring a drop in water levels at many Kansas lakes and reservoirs this fall. In some cases, the drop in water levels has revealed hidden dangers beneath the surface. Logs, sandbars, mud flats, and other hazards. The Department of Wildlife and Parks recently warned boaters about these potential hazards. Lake levels at Cheney Reservoir have fallen nearly 9 feet. Tuttle Creek near Manhattan has dropped around 5 feet over the past 2 months. A combination of dry conditions, drought, and little if any rain have all contributed to the problem. About 60% of the state is experiencing abnormally dry or drought-like conditions. And Spirit AeroSystems says it still expects to be acquired by Boeing, this despite dismal earnings reports from both companies this week. Spirit says it expects to become part of Boeing by the middle of next year. In men's college basketball, a high-profile charity exhibition game gets underway tonight between top-ranked KU and the Arkansas Razorbacks. The Jayhawks are ranked number one. They'll play in Fayetteville at 8 p.m.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. President Biden is expected to issue a formal apology today for the federal government's Native American boarding schools. With him in Arizona will be Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, America's first ever indigenous cabinet member. She made it a priority to right the government's historic wrongs, including abuses at boarding schools. Haaland recently spoke about it with NPR's Kirk Sigler at the Department of Interior.
The cavernous Stuart Udall Department of Interior building may be just off the National Mall in Washington, but it feels like a window into the Old West. Past the peculiar Indian craft shop, there are striking New Deal-era murals of firefighting and farming, and an Ansel Adams photograph of the Yakima Pueblo of New Mexico.
Our people were farming the desert for thousands of years, right, at Bears Ears and...
Yakima's just a few miles from where Deb Haaland spent much of her childhood at her grandmother's rock home in Mesita Village, Laguna Pueblo. Upstairs in the office of the department's first-ever Native secretary, Haaland says she thinks about her elders and the U.S. government's historical policy of assimilation every day.
My grandparents worked on the railroad for 45 years because of that, right? They were trying to get Indians out of their communities and into mainstream America.
Haaland's grandmother was sent to a Catholic boarding school as a little girl. School children were punished for speaking indigenous languages. Many were abused or worse, and there's still no full accounting of those who died.
It's an important piece of our history that every single American should know about. It's a painful part of our history.
Haaland, who also oversees the Bureau of Indian Affairs, recently wrapped up a nationwide healing tour across the country.
I think of that every single day. Those voices resonate with me every single day. It is very, very painful.
Haaland has also tried to right the wrongs of history by bringing tribes to the table on public lands decisions. Her department controls half a billion acres of land, including the national parks, cattle ranges, and oil and gas fields. She's increased tribal co-management agreements tenfold.
Tribal folks, they were our first land stewards. And so I feel that we've done an excellent job of lifting up Indian affairs and making sure that, across the board, it's important to our entire department.
Holland knows it's ironic that she is now leading Interior. Historians say the agency was created after this country had fought off the British colonizers, only to then begin colonizing the American West.
The Department of the Interior, I don't know, you could almost call it the Department of Intense Irony and still keep the same initials.
Patty Limerick is a Western historian at the University of Colorado.
There's no question that the Department of the Interior comes into being to manage, direct, and control Indian peoples.
But Limerick says Deb Haaland's appointment will mark an important turn.
This is proof that we are not stuck with a historical legacy. This is proof that we have the power to say, let's change this.
Indeed, across Indian country, her appointment to lead federal agencies that long deprive Native people of their wealth and power, it means a lot. Chuck Hoskin Jr. is chief of the Cherokee Nation, one of America's biggest tribes.
Oh, I think her legacy is that she empowered Indian country and gave hope to particularly a generation of young Natives who look at a powerful Native woman in a position of great power, demonstrating strength.
Haaland's appointment came with huge expectations. She herself points out that America's 574 federally recognized tribes are no monolith. And she's faced criticism for everything from tighter oil and gas drilling rules on the Navajo Reservation to not intervening in a lithium mining boom in Nevada on land tribes consider sacred. Here's how the longtime chairman of the Reno Sparks Indian Colony, Arlen Melendez, framed it before retiring late last year.
We want her to come out here at least to explain to the tribes as to what she can do, you know, besides remaining silent on it.
Haaland says she's learned it's nearly impossible to be all things to everyone, and jokes that every day at least half the country is mad at her.
With respect to some of these projects, they didn't start with this administration. There were past administrations who were working on some of these things.
She also found herself on the defense more recently over the Not Invisible Act, which she got passed as a member of Congress in 2019. It created a commission to advise the Interior and Justice Departments on their failure to solve missing persons and murder cases in Native communities. Some members criticized her for not acting fast enough. Haaland is pleading for patience, saying Native women have been trafficked since colonization for 500 years.
Can things happen faster? Of course, things can always happen faster, but we are moving forward on this issue. When before, nobody cared about it.
As a tribal administrator, she remembers going to missing Indigenous people rallies where only a few family members showed up. Like boarding schools, Haaland says these are now mainstream issues.
This was a turning point to acknowledge this painful era of our history, one that so many Americans had no clue about.
Haaland won't say whether she'd stay on if a potential Kamala Harris administration were to ask. Donald Trump would likely roll back most of the Biden agenda, particularly a new controversial rule that allows public land to be leased for conservation instead of drilling. But Cherokee Chief Chuck Hoskin says Haaland has raised the bar such that future presidents will appoint leaders who empower Indian country, not ignore it.
We have seen over the decades progress and then some level of retreat. I think overall we're on a path of progress in this country that is beyond party lines.
Secretary Haaland points to the historic $45 billion the administration set aside for tribes, for everything from clean water to schools to bringing electricity to homes that still don't have it.
We're proud that tribes have had this once-in-a-generation investment to make their communities better. Some, you know, there's tribes like the Hopi tribe in Arizona who are able to electrify homes with solar power for the first time ever.
Haaland says she and the Biden administration have done things that will change Native people's lives forever, no matter who's in charge next. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Washington.
Later today, in All Things Considered, the WNBA is getting larger crowds, more viewers, and bigger buzz than ever before. Player salaries, though, have not kept up. So the WNBA Players Association says it's time to bargain for a brand new contract. Listen live on the NPR app or your local station.
This is NPR News.
Support for KPR comes from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas, offering a local team to help businesses invest in the health of their employees with a choice of benefit options. Learn more at bcbsks.com/business.
It's Morning Edition on Kansas Public Radio. Here's a severe storm update from Evergy regarding the thousands of outages from last night. At its peak, the outages were around 17,000 across eastern, northeastern Kansas and western Missouri. Right now, that's down to about 705 customers without power, about 58 active outages. Here's what Evergy has to say. They expect those affected by the storm to have power restored by 4 o'clock today, with the majority of those customers being restored by noon today. Well, we've got power here at KPR, and that's a good thing because it's live day when we bring you a whole day's worth of classical music performed live here at the KPR studios in Lawrence and at the Lawrence Public Library. Things will kick off on KPR 1 at 9 o'clock this morning, so don't touch that dial. Live day is coming up this morning on Kansas Public Radio.
There are guitars galore this week on Live at Green Lady Lounge when we hear from Guitar Elation, featuring two of Kansas City's top guitar pickers, Danny Embry and Brian Baggett. I'm Darryl Brogdon. Hope you'll join us for Live at Green Lady Lounge, Saturday at 6 p.m. on KPR.
Good morning, May Martinez. A lady in Ipswich, England, was out during the early hours one morning this week, and she saw a pinkish-reddish glow. At first, she thought it was something on fire. Then she remembered the northern lights were spotted in the UK skies a couple of weeks earlier and thought, was it an aurora? And she started snapping some pictures. Her social media followers let her know it was just the lights from a nearby tomato factory used to boost plant growth. Wah, wah. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters this Thursday. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. The Federal Trade Commission has approved a regulation called the Click aimed at companies that make it intentionally difficult for customers to cancel subscriptions, which you might have noticed are now a pretty big business model. Alexi Horowitz-Ghazi of our Planet Money team looked at why.
For a long time, the subscription business model was kind of niche. Think newspapers or milk delivery. But now, everything from razor blades to car washes are available as a subscription. To figure out why, I reached out to Teen Zwo, the founder and CEO of a subscription logistics company called Zwora.
We're a little bit invisible, right, to you. You might not know that we exist, but we're powering the money transactions behind anything from Zoom to the New York Times to General Motors, to power all sorts of subscription services.
Teen explains that our modern subscription-obsessed economy can be traced back to one Silicon Valley company in the late 90s, where he was an early employee.
Well, I think the company that people would point to is Salesforce.
Salesforce makes database software for other companies to keep track of sales and marketing. And up until that point, Teen says, the software industry was organized around selling individual goods, CDs with programs like Microsoft Word or Adobe Photoshop.
Despite the fact that software was a digital product, it was very much sold on a unit basis.
The thing that Teen and his colleagues at Salesforce realized was that in the age of the internet, they could try a different model.
Let's create software that people don't have to buy, that we run, that we operate, and you simply point your browser at our servers, and we'll just take care of it for you.
Salesforce started offering their software as a service. Now, instead of buying your own copy of some program for a hefty sticker price, you can essentially rent it and spread the cost into smaller, recurring payments every month. That made it affordable to more customers, and it gave Salesforce a more predictable stream of income. Within a few years, the company proved this model could be a $1 billion business. Venture capitalists started investing more into startups that offered software as a service, and the model blew up with things like Netflix and Spotify. At this point, does it feel like there's a kind of pressure on almost any type of company if they're trying to convince investors to back them to use a subscription model?
I think I'd be hard-pressed to see a venture capitalist fund a company that does not have a strong recurring subscription model.
But the ubiquity of the subscription model has also come with a dark side. Over the past few years, consumer protection agencies like the Federal Trade Commission have received tens of thousands of complaints from customers about companies with opaque terms of service and cancellation processes that are nearly impossible.
Subscription traps are a market failure.
Sam Levine is the head of consumer protection at the FTC. The agency has brought several high-profile lawsuits against companies that they see as the worst offenders. And earlier this month, they passed Click to Cancel, requiring companies to make it just as easy to cancel a service as it was to sign up or risk a fine.
Yeah, you can trap people and maybe it'll earn you another $6.99 a month. But if you're caught, you could be liable for civil penalties of more than $50,000 per violation. And that's just basic deterrence theory.
Sam says the rule is slated to go into effect in about 6 months. In the meantime, he says, there are apps to track and cancel your subscriptions for you, but only if you're willing to pay a monthly fee. Alexi Horowitz-Ghazi, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News.
You know, here at KPR, we're trying to get everyone to take out a monthly subscription to Kansas Public Radio. But here's the deal, and here's what makes us different. If you ever want to cancel, just call us up. Talk to a real person, or send us an email. It's easy to cancel your monthly subscription to Kansas Public Radio. Obviously, we hope you don't. We hope you'll keep paying us $5 or $10 or $15 a month or $1 a day or what have you, so we can keep bringing you programs like Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Live Day, which is about 10 minutes away here on Kansas Public Radio. We will kick things off in the 9 o'clock hour on KPR1 with music from the Midwest Chamber Ensemble of Kansas City. They'll be playing trio music for piano, cello, and French horn. And then around 10 o'clock this morning, we'll switch over and go live from the Lawrence Public Library for music from the Blue Stem Wind Ensemble, plus a great classical saxophonist, those musicians from Washburn University. It's all about live classical music this morning on KPR, so we hope you'll stay with us. If you just can't get enough of the news and talk, well, there's always KPR2. Coming up at 9 a.m. on KPR2, it's the BBC News Hour.
This month's KPR Community Spotlights on Cherry Street Youth in Chanute, a Christian-based ministry formed to help develop children emotionally, spiritually, physically, and academically with after-school classes in gardening, cooking, art, and more. Details at cherrystreet.org.
Sunny and breezy weather in store. We'll have a high of 68 degrees.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. With the presidential election just a week and a half away, both candidates keep talking about the last one and what happened right after it. But how Vice President Harris and former President Trump described January 6th could not be more different.
Some of those people went down to the Capitol. I said, peacefully and patriotically, nothing done wrong.
He sent an armed mob to the United States Capitol, where they assaulted law enforcement officers.
But that was a day of love.
He fanned the flames.
Nearly 4 years later, the nation has still come to terms with what happened at the storming of the Capitol and who participated. An NPR investigation shows nearly one in five people arrested in connection with the attack have military service records. One of them was Sergeant Josh Abate, who followed the crowd along with two fellow Marines, Sergeant Dodge Helenan and Corporal Micah Coomer. NPR's Tom Bowman and Lauren Hodges followed the story for a new podcast with our colleagues at Embedded. Here's a snippet.
Josh sat down with both of us for hours, talked about how he ended up in the Capitol. The election had just wrapped up, and he was buying into the claims on conservative media outlets that Joe Biden's victory had been fraudulent.
Now, Josh claims he just went to D.C. on January 6th to hear Trump speak and ended up in the wrong place at the wrong time, the Capitol attack. He describes a very different scene than what Lauren and I saw out there that day. He says, there was no violence, no aggression. They just walked in, strolled around the Capitol, took pictures. That just didn't sound right to us. No chanting, no big crowds, we asked. Nope. I have nothing to hide, Josh told us.
And you said you wanted to add a few things?
Yeah, I got a couple bullet points.
Okay.
When we sat down, he handed me this one sheet of paper. It was part of the FBI's official statement of facts. And he's like, look, this is all they've got on me.
They appears in the crowd. And then he walks, and it talks about how we walk,
right.
And nothing in their summary of our actions is actually, you know, violent or scary.
He kept using the word humorous.
I thought it was humorous that they, in their summary of me, like my time in the Capitol building, that's all they could really sum it up to was walking.
And then I looked at the bottom of the page, and it says, like, 1 of 45.
But there's more to this story than just some missing pages. There's also video evidence.
The FBI investigation into Josh relied on these screenshots in the Capitol that mostly came from surveillance footage inside. We didn't have access to that. But a few weeks after we talked to Josh, we got an unexpected assist. House Republicans started dropping some 5,000 hours of security camera footage from January 6th on a public video platform.
7 minutes after the doors and windows to the hallway are breached, Josh walks in with Helenan and Coomer.
They slowly make their way to the front of this crowd about 20 feet away from the door to the House chamber. And at one point, Josh cups his hands around his mouth. And when you watch the video, it's pretty clear he's chanting, "Stop the steal, stop the steal."
At another point, Josh is holding a "Don't Tread on Me" flag, just before tear gas starts to fill the space.
At that point, Josh and his friends leave that hallway and end up in the Capitol Rotunda in a huge crowd. They help a guy try to put a MAGA hat on a statue, and Josh is the one who finally gets it up there by actually climbing the statue.
When Josh admitted to putting a hat on a statue, he told us he didn't remember which statue it was. But Lauren and I have seen this bust up close. In shiny gold lettering, it reads,
Martin Luther King Jr.
It's hard to miss.
It's only when the police, in riot gear no less, form a line and start to push everyone out that Josh, along with Helenan and Coomer, are finally forced to leave the rotunda. It's clear that the video doesn't match up with Josh's story. Josh said he didn't see any violence. It was peaceful. He didn't do anything but walk around. That's just not true.
That's NPR's Lauren Hodges and Tom Bowman. Their new podcast with Embedded called A Good Guy is out now on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts. A juvenile humpback whale nicknamed Sweet Girl died near the main island of Tahiti. That spurred an effort to change how fast boats can travel during whale watching season. Here's NPR's Likiros.
In this video captured by the environmental group Mata Tahora, we hear Sweet Girl crying in pain. She struggles to keep swimming as blood pours from a deep cut in her upper mouth. Locals believe she was hit and killed by a large speeding vessel. Underwater photographer Rachel Moore lives on Tahiti and was swimming with Sweet Girl just days before the accident.
Sweet Girl was coming around to see everyone in the water.
In a video on Moore's Instagram, the curious whale twirls in the water and doesn't shy away from the humans.
It was the most powerful 10 minutes of my life.
When Moore found out about Sweet Girl's death, she was devastated. Authorities are still trying to figure out who's responsible, but there is speculation that the boat that hit Sweet Girl was traveling about 34 miles per hour, almost six times the current speed limit for vessels traveling near Tahiti. That is why Moore has started a petition to change the speed limit during whale watching season.
If ships can stay below 12 knots, at least inside of the lagoon in the first 2 kilometers, that alone will protect a larger percentage of whales here.
Thousands of whales are killed by vessels every year. But this incident, which has garnered international support, pits the need for islanders and tourists to get around directly against the whales that frequent the South Pacific Island territory to mate and give birth.
Personally, I got really affected because I've been swimming with the whales recently with my friends.
Caroline Rainbow is a travel consultant on the island of Mo'odia, about 33 miles from Tahiti. She signed the petition. Still, she says even though whale watching season is very popular, locals are split about changing the speed limit for boats.
A lot of the people that actually commute to go to Tahiti, going back morning and night on the ferries, they only want one thing, to reach the island in about 25 minutes because they're so tired at the end of the day that they just want to reach the island.
The petition currently has some 15,000 signatures. Rachel Moore has a higher goal, 280,000, the population of French Polynesia, before she officially presents the petition to the government. Lily Quiros, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
Support for KPR comes from the Lawrence Farmers Market, accepting credit, debit, or SNAP cards in exchange for tokens. Multiple double-up programs available to match SNAP dollars. Learn more at the Market Info Booth, Saturday mornings at 824 New Hampshire.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. This is KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, and KANQ Chanute. You'll find us broadcasting online at kansaspublicradio.org. Well, guess what's coming up next? Have you heard us talk about this? Live day on KPR. Get ready for a morning filled with classical music performed live, either from our KPR Live Performance Studio or the Lawrence Public Library. We're going to kick things off in the 9 o'clock hour here with the Midwest Chamber Ensemble of Kansas City. They'll be playing trio music, piano, cello, French horn. And then around 10 o'clock this morning, we'll head on over to the Lawrence Public Library, where we will bring you, live from the library, the Bluestem Wind Ensemble and great classical saxophone music, all from some Washburn University folks. Stick around for Live Day. That's next. It's 9:01, sunny and 53 degrees here at KPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Both Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump are campaigning today in Texas. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports it's an unusual stop for presidential candidates to make in the last stretch of the election.
Trump will be in Austin to record a podcast episode with Joe Rogan before heading to Michigan for a rally. Harris, meanwhile, will rally in Houston with Senate candidate Colin Allred. Texas hasn't had a Democratic senator in 30 years, but Colin Allred's race this year against incumbent Senator Ted Cruz is tight, in part because of the focus on reproductive rights. Harris's visit to Houston will highlight the issue as her campaign tries to keep it top of mind for voters in the last stretch of the election. Her rally will also have a special guest, Beyonce, whose song Freedom Harris has been using as her walkout song. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, Houston.
Lebanon's state-run news agency says an Israeli airstrike in Lebanon has killed 3 media staffers. The strike came in an area used by several different media organizations. One of the journalists killed was a cameraman working for a network operated by Hezbollah. The Los Angeles County District Attorney is making a new recommendation in an old murder case. Los Angeles County DA George Gascon says brothers Lyle and Eric Menendez should be resentenced. They were sentenced to life in prison without parole after murdering their parents in 1989. At the time, prosecutors rejected Eric's claim of sexual abuse by his father. Gascon says there is new evidence of sexual abuse and that they could be eligible for a shorter prison term.
Under the law, since they were under 26 years of age, at the time that these crimes occurred, they will be eligible for parole immediately.
But a judge, a parole board, and the California governor must also agree with the district attorney before the brothers could be released. Stocks opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported a drop in orders for long-lasting manufactured products. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 180 points in early trading.
Orders for durable goods fell by 0.8% last month, weighed down by a sharp drop in orders for civilian aircraft. Excluding transportation, durable goods orders were up. McDonald's has identified a California onion supplier as the possible source of an E. coli outbreak linked to the chain's Quarter Pounders. Taylor Farms of Salinas, California has issued an onion recall. Other fast food chains are pulling onions from their menus as a precaution. Crude oil prices are up, but retail gasoline prices continue to fall. AAA says the average price of the pump is now $3.14 a gallon. That's down about a nickel from a week ago and 40 cents lower than this time last year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up about 170 points. The NASDAQ is up nearly 1.3%. It's NPR. The company that owns a ship that collapsed Baltimore's Key Bridge earlier this year has agreed to pay more than $100 million in damages. The disaster killed six people and closed the port of Baltimore for months. More than 32 million voters have cast their ballots as part of early voting in this fall's general election. As NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports, time is running out for eligible voters to get registered in some states.
If you're eligible but haven't signed up yet in Nebraska, today is the last chance to register to vote in this fall's election. Eligible Nebraskans can stop by their county election office, or if they happen to be applying for or renewing their driver's license today, sign up in person at the Department of Motor Vehicles. If you're already registered, you may want to check your registration status soon. Voters can sometimes fall off a registration list or need to update the information if they moved, changed their name, or haven't voted in a while. Eligible voters still have time to sign up in person or online in Massachusetts and New York, but those registration windows close on Saturday. The Postal Service is urging all mail-in voters to return their ballots at least 1 week before their state's deadlines. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News.
The World Series opens tonight in Los Angeles when the Dodgers welcome the New York Yankees. But L.A. Mayor Karen Bass is warning residents of a potential Carmageddon or a traffic nightmare. There's the World Series, but fans will also see the L.A. Lakers host the Phoenix Suns tonight. The USC football team has a game. Tomorrow night, the NHL's Los Angeles Kings welcome the Utah Hockey Club. And then there are music concerts scheduled, too. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fisher Investments,